You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Talk Nation Radio.
Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson.
It is my great privilege to welcome to Talk Nation Radio Hussein Abdullah. He is originally from Bahrain. He is the founder and executive director of Americans for Democracy and Human Rights in Bahrain. The website, a very nice website, is at ADHRB.org. ADHRB, Americans for Democracy and Human Rights in Bahrain. Hussein leads the organization's efforts to ensure that U.S. policies support the democracy and human rights movement in Bahrain. Hussein also works closely with members of the Bahraini American community to ensure that their voices are heard by U.S. government officials and the broader American public. In 2012, the government of Bahrain revoked Hussein's Bahraini citizenship in retaliation for his peaceful advocacy for the respect for human rights in his home country. Hussein Abdullah, welcome to Talk Nation Radio.
Well, thank you very much for having me. I really appreciate it.
We have had some guests on from Bahrain. We have talked about the issue of Bahrain on this show, but I still suspect that many in the United States know very little about it. I don't know if you think that suspicion is accurate or not, but could you tell people where Bahrain is, what kind of country it is, what life is like there, or at least what it used to be like there?
Sure. I think I agree that many people do not know where Bahrain is. However, it's important to know where it is because it is the headquarters of the United States Fifth Fleet Navy, one of the most important military base we have, or Navy base we have in the world. Bahrain is a very tiny country. It's an island in the Persian Gulf, neighboring Saudi Arabia and Qatar, and it's a country that has a very vibrant and active citizenry that is pushing for democracy, rule of law, and human rights for decades, for years and years. And with the Arab Spring, also Bahrain had its own chapter of peaceful movement toward democracy. It took place on February 14th, 2011, which is basically, February 14th, which is Valentine's Day.
And, obviously, if the United States wanted to overthrow the government of Bahrain, everybody in the United States would hear about Bahrain and how evil Bahrain is every day, endlessly. But the U.S. relationship with the government of Bahrain is not so much one of hostility, is it?
No, it's not. And let me just put it this way. I don't think your audience will be surprised or will object when I say that the United States uses the argument for democracy as a convenience against our enemies or against the regimes that we don't like. However, regimes like Saudi Arabia, United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, including, and so many other Middle Eastern friendly nations who abuses their citizens, who has the most horrible human rights record, we don't hear, the U.S. or whether it's the Obama administration or even the previous administration, and I think also the future administration, will advocate for democracy or rule of law or a change of regime in those countries, because we have very friendly relationships. They do what we want them to do. So in the case of Bahrain, there is no call for regime change. And as a matter of fact, the people of Bahrain not calling for any nation to intervene in their matter. There is no one in Bahrain calling for the U.S. to wage war against the current government. The people of Bahrain, I think, capable enough to decide or have their day of self-determination if basically they get the support and through the diplomatic and international pressure on the Bahraini government to do the right thing. I think overwhelming majority of the people of Bahrain wants a peaceful democratic process, wants a peaceful power sharing, away from any kind of military intervention or foreign nation intervening in the country to change the political dynamic.
But, of course, the U.S. military is there and is not opposing but supporting the current government, and Saudi Arabia, the larger neighbor of Bahrain, is supporting the current government. Presumably you would like that support to end.
I mean, you basically stated an important fact. Because of the Navy fleet, I think we turn a blind eye or not pressure Bahrain enough. Just raising concern or making a statement here and there is not going to pressure the Bahraini government or force them to respect human rights and start a serious political reform. Much more is needed. At the same time, we have the biggest abuser of human rights, if not in the world, in the region, Saudi Arabia, actually occupying Bahrain. There are over... or close to 3,000 Saudi troops in Bahrain since March 2011. They came into the country to crush the pro-democratic movement. So having those forces in Bahrain with the political support that the ruling family receives from the U.S. and other international, Western powerful countries, I don't think there'll be any serious changes in the country, because you know, the movement in the country, not only faces the Al Khalifa government or the Bahraini regime, but also faces, you know, countries like Saudi Arabia and UAE, who give it heavy support to the Al Khalifa. Add on top of that the support from Western, key Western ally like the United States and the United Kingdom.
And what has been the human rights record of the monarchy in Bahrain since 2011?
I mean, I'm not going to quote independent non-government organization like Amnesty or Human Rights Watch, because they're extremely critical. But our own Department of State report, the Obama administration themselves, in its annual report for human rights in Bahrain, clearly state horrible facts that happened in the country. Torture is systematic, arbitrary detention, enforced disappearance, sexual harassment. People don't see, don't have access to adequate legal counsel. There is no independence of the judiciary system. Religious discrimination is widespread. There is serious instability in the country. And basically, it is a nation that is ruled like a private property by a single ruling family that is a tiny majority of the population.
And yet this is a government that, despite the United States government's own understanding of its outrageous abuses, feels free to support and to sell weaponry and to transfer weaponry. I believe Bahrain, certainly Saudi Arabia, was on a list of nations that Secretary of State Hillary Clinton waived various concerns and approved weapon sales to after those nations had supported her personal family foundation with contributions. So there is that level of corruption in the U.S. government, and that level of contradiction within the U.S. government, that it understands the abuses but waves them aside. How can which view is going to win out, and how can the U.S. government be moved to a better position?
I mean, the problem of the GCC countries, and I'm talking about these six countries, Bahrain included in them, Saudi Arabia, Bahrain, UAE, and Qatar, and others. They have so much political power in Washington. They have so much political influence in Washington. They buy so much weapons from the United States. You're talking about serious dollar here, serious money that comes from GCC into this country to buy weaponry. They have the biggest lobbying firm represent them in Washington. They have all the ex-senators and ex-congressmen who you can imagine work on their behalf to pressure or to influence political decisions coming out from different administrations. And here I want to just be fair. I don't want to criticize only this administration, although, I mean, they deserve criticism. However, this goes back, as I said, the Bush administration, Bush the second, you know, W or his father, Bush, or President Clinton. And unfortunately, I expect even the future president will treat this the same way, and that is military cooperation, weapon purchases, economic relationship, oil, will basically come first, and human rights not even be discussed. And that's not actually buying stability, because, I mean, the entire region is going through changes, and if we don't show that we care about the demands of the population or the people, eventually whoever is going to rule these countries in the future, they're going to remember that which side we took.
The corruption of the U.S. government by Saudi Arabia seems to be about oil sales and weapon purchases. In Bahrain, the bigger factor, as you've mentioned, may be the U.S. Navy's Fifth Fleet parking its ships in Bahrain. If you go to the website of the Fifth Fleet, it claims to be responsible, its word, for a list of nations in that region, a couple of dozen nations. I don't know that any of those nations have ever asked the Fifth Fleet to be responsible for them. I don't know that any of them have ever benefited from the Fifth Fleet in any way. What is the benefit to anyone in that region of the world of the Fifth Fleet being there in Bahrain?
I'm not a military expert. However, I think Fifth Fleet plays a major role to make sure that the energy flow, the oil flow in the Persian Gulf goes smoothly. I don't know if you remember, a year or two ago, we had serious problem of piracy toward the Somalia area and the Strait of Bab el-Mandeb, and the Fifth Fleet played a role in combating that. Also, it's basically, you know, one of the biggest, if not the most important, navy base or naval base we have in that region that can carry operation if needed. I mean, whether it was against Al-Qaeda in Iraq or the war in Afghanistan or even the war in Iraq. So it does play a major role in most of our military operation in that region. Now, again, I'm not an expert. Did it help or did not help? I think, you know, Kuwait would have not been liberated easily if the Fifth Fleet was not in Bahrain. So it does play a major role in protecting the region from the bad player, but also, unfortunately, is used by these regimes, these bad regimes, these autocratic, authoritarian regimes, to basically prop them up and support them and make them powerful. And I think there is a balance that we can protect our interest in the region and at the same time make sure that these countries are up to speed when it comes to human rights and political reform and having a population that can express their opinion freely without being tortured and arrested, and also rule their countries in a representative political system.
I don't want to stray to too many topics on which I have no expertise, and you may not either, but, you know, that it's in our interests, meaning you and me and our neighbors and our friends, not the Pentagon. I'm not using we to mean the Pentagon, but that it's in our interests for the oil to continue flowing smoothly out of the Persian Gulf seems odd to me when I saw a study this past week that said that in Saudi Arabia and Bahrain and that region, by the end of this century, the temperatures of 160 to 170, 180 degrees Fahrenheit would be intolerable for the human body to survive if the consumption of oil continued at even a fraction of its current rate. How is continuing that in the interests of
the world, and in particular, the interests of that region, which is going to suffer the worst of it.
I don't think, it's unfortunately, but I think it's the fact that I don't think we care about their internal policies. I think they've been abusing these countries, GCC countries, Qatar, Saudi Arabia, Bahrain, and others, been abusing the migrant workers for years. So I think it will continue. I mean, we just see it in Qatar. Look how many people were killed and died while they're building these massive stadiums for the World Cup. And there is no serious outrage or punishment to the Qatari government. So the simple answer is, I don't think we care.
Well, we're going to have to work on that and start caring. It's interesting, some of the advocacy around human rights in Bahrain has focused on sort of endorsements and sanctioning of Bahrain that have come from world sporting events and world culture and Formula One races in Bahrain. And recently your organization, Hussein Abdullah, as I understand, is taking up the question of a nominee for a position on FIFA from Bahrain. Can you tell people about that?
Yes. Thank you for bringing up this important topic. I mean, look, there is the former head of Bahrain Football Association, and football here we mean soccer. His name is Sheikh Salman bin Ibrahim Al Khalifa. He is a cousin, first cousin of the king. And during the pro-democracy movement or uprising in 2011, every sector of the society participated in that, and which included football players and football teams and football like team managers and other administrative positions. So what he did, this guy, he headed a committee when the crackdown began, to name and to pick and to basically identify all the players and teams and team managers and referees and coaches who participated in the peaceful protest, and identify them and make and basically they were picked up by the police, they were tortured, imprisoned, they were banned from playing football. They were basically punished. And a person like this, who is basically engaged in crime against humanity, including torture, should not lead the most respected body of football in the world, and that's FIFA. I mean, basically, if he could not protect the players, the football players in Bahrain, he will. What kind of legitimacy he has to respect the football players of the world? I mean, nominating someone like this gives hope to the families of families like Saddam Hussein's family and Gaddafi's family and all the dictators in the world, that if they need to clean their image, the best thing is to run for some position like FIFA. So basically, FIFA here is acting like a PR firm for this notorious family or this notorious person with his horrible background of engaging in such crime. So we launched a campaign with a sister organization in London and other parts to make sure that the world knows and the officials at FIFA Ethic Committee and Integrity Committee to know that what kind of person this is. And I think we were able to raise reasonable and good media attention around this person. And I think we will continue doing so to make sure that he's not elected to this position. And if he is elected, we'll make sure there'll be some legal accountability to his actions and hold FIFA accountable. And every big corporation who supports FIFA, that they are engaging with an organization that it's the president or the head of the organization is engaged in crimes against humanity.
And if people in the United States, there is at least some growing interest in soccer, but there certainly ought to be some interest in human rights and decency. If people want to help, can they go to the website for Americans for Democracy and Human Rights in Bahrain, adhrb.org, or what can people do?
Well, people can do many things. First of all, I would ask them and encourage them, if they don't have time to write email or write letters, to pick up the phone and call your congressman and tell him to support the bill that is introduced by Congressman McGovern and Congressman James Pitt and Congressman Hank Johnson. I think the number of that legislation is 3445. And to co-sponsor that legislation. So tell your congressman to co-sponsor a legislation in the Congress that will ban any arms sales to Bahrain unless they reform their political system and respect human rights. There are other details in the bill, but that's not the subject here. Also, to pick up, also to call your two senators from your state and tell your two senators to support another legislation, a similar legislation in the Senate, with number 2009, introduced by Senator Wyden and Senator Rubio. Ask them to co-sponsor that legislation, which basically does the same job as the House version. Also, follow, sign up for our newsletter, which includes some action items that you can take, mainly through congressional pressure. And of course, I mean, we're a not-for-profit organization. We're tax-deductible, so if you are in a position to donate, we're certainly going to welcome that. Another important thing, if you are a member of an organization, whether it's labor or human rights, we would welcome if you have events that you hold on a regular basis. If you want to hold an event on Bahrain, that would be something. But if you visit the website, you'll see many things you could engage in. And, of course, you'll see that we not only work on Bahrain, we work on other countries in the GCC, which might interest your, you know, the areas you care about when it comes to human rights, whether it's women, children, or victim of abuse and so many other topics.
And that website, again, is ADHRB, stands for Americans for Democracy and Human Rights in Bahrain, ADHRB.org. There also is an online petition that your organization, Hussein, set up with an organization I work with, RootsAction.org, and a number of other groups urging support for that legislation and no more weapons for Bahrain, and that can be found at rootsaction.org, which is also just launching a similar effort urging no more U.S. weapons shipments to Saudi Arabia, which of course has some impact. As you say, Saudi Arabia is occupying Bahrain. We're speaking with Hussein Abdullah from Americans for Democracy and Human Rights in Bahrain. We have just a few minutes left. Hussein, what are your goals? Where would you like to see Bahrain 10 years from now? And do you ever hope to return there?
Thank you for bringing the website, which calls. And I think we did reach our initial goal, which was 10,000. Then we increased it to 15,000. Petition call for support of those two legislation that I have mentioned earlier, whether it's the House or the Senate, on banning arms sale to Bahrain. Regarding your last question, I mean, I would like to see a sensible policy from the United States, from whether it's this administration or the future administration, not toward Bahrain especially, but also toward other GCC countries in the region. And I mean by sensible policy, a serious change from only military cooperation and caring about the military-to-military relationship to actually pushing these countries to start changing and respecting human rights and allowing people to basically have a representative system of government. If we don't allow that, eventually things is going to get worse than what it is now. also basically holding these regimes accountable to the crimes they have done and stop selling weapons and arms to them unless they show that they are basically a responsible partner. You cannot have partners like Saudi Arabia and call them allies. I mean, imagine like you're walking on the street and you just say, my best friend he abuses his wife or he beats his wife all the time, and you act like, you know, he's your best guy. And this is what we're doing here. We are calling Saudi Arabia our strategic partner or ally. Look what they're doing to their people, whether it's their treatment of women or the treatment of anyone who differ with them. Same thing in Bahrain. Bahrain has a ruling family who basically shut down any kind of dissent. So I would like to see the people of Bahrain given an opportunity to decide what kind of political future they would like to see. Certainly, I would love to go back to Bahrain and visit and see my family there. But unfortunately, right now, I don't think it's the right time for me to go back for mainly safety issues. They have revoked my citizenship, and I'm certain if I go back, I'll be faced with lots of difficulties, not only not limited or not only just imprisonment, but so many other things. I mean, there are serious life issues here. So I would like to see Bahrain peaceful, Bahrain that has no political prisoners, Bahrain that has no torture, and go after those who committed this crime. Who no longer ruled by only one family, but ruled by a representative political system where people can choose their leader in free and fair democratic election.
Should there be, we have just a minute left, should there be sanctions by foreign countries against the government of Bahrain?
Well, I'm not a big sanction fan because those sanctions only hurt the people and not the political elite. I would like to see sanction against individual Al Khalifa members. I would like to see sanction against those who are in power right now, go after their bank accounts in the West, go after their property. But sanction against government, I'm not a big proponent of that because it basically hurts the role, the normal citizen, and does not affect, does not change anything on the ground. That actually, it strengthens the political elite and the political system and does not weaken them.
Good to know and good advice. And there is much more to be found at the website, adhrb.org, Americans for Democracy and Human Rights in Bahrain. The U.S. government is clearly not supporting democracy or human rights in Bahrain, but using those justifications for making warfare on other countries in that region. Hussein Abdullah is the founder and executive director. Hussein, thank you very, very much for coming on Talk Nation Radio.
Thank you for having me.
This is Talk Nation Radio. I'm David Swanson. Take action at rootsaction.org. At Roots Action right now, you can sign a petition to insist the Paris tragedy not be exploited for more war. At this time of grief, our hearts go out to the people of France as well as the people of Syria, Iraq, Lebanon, Russia, Bahrain, and other countries traumatized by deadly violence, people of all races, religions, and nationalities. Help end war at worldbeyondwar.org. All past shows can be heard at davidswanson.org. Talk Nation Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. If you are listening to a nonprofit station, please support that station. Talk Nation Radio is funded by contributors at davidswanson.org. There is no way to peace. Peace is the way. Until next time.
listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Countersmith.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines of the mainstream news. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, the Paris attacks by the group known as ISIS have dominated news outlets. But if the goal really is to prevent the recurrence of such violence, then reporting that eliminates the political context can't be the way forward. We'll talk about the differing ways corporate media report terrorist violence with FAIR's own Jim Narikas. Also on the show, in the wake of the Paris attacks, the word is that activism at the upcoming UN conference on climate change in that city may be restrained. But activism outside of these global gatherings is often the source of a clearer picture of where we stand on the problem, as opposed to where we need to be. Janet Redman is director of the Climate Policy Program at the Institute for Policy Studies. She'll join us to talk about that. That's coming up, but first, as usual, we'll take a quick look back at the week's press. In its effort to vet one of the leading GOP presidential candidates, Dr. Ben Carson, the New York Times didn't properly vet its primary source in this vetting, former CIA officer Dwayne Claridge, an indicted liar and overseer of Contra death squads in Central America. Times reporter Trip Gabriel briefly notes the former, but completely omits the latter, instead offering a description of Claridge as, quote, a colorful, even legendary figure in intelligence circles, someone who could have stepped out of a Hollywood thriller, close quote. As head of Reagan's CIA division in Latin America in the 1980s, Claridge took part in the effort to overthrow Nicaragua's Sandinista government by illegally supplying funds and arms to the Contras, a right-wing terrorist movement that committed brutal war crimes. He boasts in his memoir of coming up with the idea of mining Nicaragua's harbors to interfere with shipping, which Barry Goldwater pointed out in a letter to CIA Director William Casey was an act of war and resulted, predictably, in civilian deaths. That didn't trouble Claridge, nor evidently the New York Times, which alludes vaguely to Iran-Contra, but without mentioning the, you know, death squads. We do learn that Claridge sprinkles his remarks with salty language. But even that is glossed over when Gabriel reports that Claridge dismisses the idea of there being Chinese troops in Syria, quote, using an ethnic slur for the Chinese, close quote. Ben Carson's lack of policy knowledge is a perfectly valid story, but telling it need not whitewash the bloody, or excuse me, colorful past of his primary international advisor. Daniel Holtzclaw, a former Oklahoma City police officer, standing trial on 36 counts, including rape, sexual battery, and stalking. 12 women and one 17-year-old girl have come forward saying Holtzclaw assaulted them while on patrol. Most of the victims were black, poor, and embroiled in the criminal justice system for things like prostitution and drug use, a precarious state that Holtzclaw allegedly used to threaten and coerce them. As the 17-year-old put it in her testimony, what am I going to do, call the cops? He was a cop. The alleged crimes are disturbing, so too the evident media disinterest. Outside of Oklahoma, the case has thus far garnered little mainstream attention. A Nexus search indicates neither the New York Times nor the Washington Post have printed any original reporting, nor has Nightly Broadcast News addressed a story that brings together emergent questions of police violence and rape culture. An Associated Press investigation showed around 1,000 police officers fired over a six-year period for so-called sex crimes, including rape, certainly an undercount, given that it only includes those who actually lost their badges. The Federal Bureau of Justice Statistics, which collects data on police, doesn't track officer arrests, and states aren't required to collect or share that information. Daniel Holtzclaw evidently selected his victims because he believed no one would care about them. Media shouldn't prove him right. And finally, David Brooks' November 13th piece for the New York Times Travel magazine reads like a joke. Is the Times columnist seriously regaling readers with talk of his spectacularly expensive hopscotch on a self-contained luxury caravan? The piece, titled My $120,000 Vacation, details Brooks's time flying around the world on a Four Seasons-branded private jet. And yes, the paper paid for it. So is the Times seriously asking for our interest in the merits and demerits of such pampered high-end travel? And how Brooks enjoyed his superfluous second bottle of champagne? And how he wished there had been a little more intellectual and spiritual ambition among his fellow travelers from the lower end of the upper class? Are we meant to chuckle at his closing line? Quote, "Of course we all have a responsibility to reduce inequality in our society, but maybe not every day," close quote. It's almost a no comment. Almost. Because Brooks isn't a travel writer. Most days, the Times wants us to take seriously his opinions on public assistance, which is that welfare has served as a cushion, not a ladder, because, quote, "the real barriers to mobility are matters of social psychology," close quote. Or his opinions on democracy. American politics has become neurotically democratic, Brooks says, suggesting instead a process that would be, quote, "unapologetically elitist. Gather small groups of the great and the good together to hammer out bipartisan reforms and then rally establishment opinion to browbeat the plans through," close quote. Or on college campus activists whose, quote, "moral fervor is structured by those who seek the innocent purity of the vulnerable victim," close quote. So at a time when 92 million Americans are out of the labor force, the highest number in four decades, 15% of the population live below the poverty line, which is $24,250 for a family of four, when inequality is skyrocketing such that 80 billionaires now control the same wealth as 3.5 billion people, the fact that a supposedly serious columnist at the country's paper of record thinks it's cute to talk about how, quote, "sometimes it is the structure of things that you shall be pampered and you have no choice but to sit back and accept that fact," close quote, seems pretty darn unfunny. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR. The Paris attacks were barely over before people began using them for their own purposes. They were a reason to reject Syrian refugees, though no refugees appear to have been implicated. They were a reason to increase government surveillance, although the suspects were already on the French government's radar, and there's no indication more surveillance would have made any difference. Some even used the attacks as cause to demean anti-racist activism on college campuses. But many people also asked whether this violence might finally cause us to consider how the war on terror may foment rather than prevent such acts, as well as raise questions about media's selective attention to violence around the world and what our guest terms the weaponization of grief. Jim Narikas is editor of FAIR's website and our newsletter Extra. Welcome back to Counterspin, Jim Narikas.
Great to be back.
Well, nobody wants to be part of a suffering Olympics, but is there something to be said about the differing ways that media have directed our attention and our sympathies in the wake of various violent acts over the last couple of weeks?
It is kind of a natural experiment where you have one group carrying out similar attacks in a short period of time against very different targets, and against targets that have very different values in the U.S. media system. You have Paris attack, but before that, just before that, there was a twin bombing in Beirut carried out by ISIS. And shortly before that, ISIS apparently brought down a Russian plane over Egypt's Sinai Peninsula. And by looking at how these stories were covered, you see a lot about what the the U.S. media bring to the story, how their ideology and preconceptions change how they present what are in some ways very similar events.
Well, we saw how the Paris attack was covered. It was the front page and the top of the news for days and continues to be. Everyone on Facebook changed their icon to the French colors. How does that compare to, for example, the attack in Beirut, which immediately preceded the Paris attacks?
Well, that was treated as an incident of passing notice. The New York Times published a story on page 6. And interestingly, at one point, the headline of the New York Times referred to it as an attack against a Hezbollah stronghold. And you saw this kind of terminology in different media referring to the suburb that was attacked as a Hezbollah bastion or a Hezbollah area, as if by bombing a marketplace in Beirut, ISIS was somehow striking a blow against a rival militant group. And actually, as the New York Times story noted, the justification issued by ISIS for killing these people was that they were Shia. They were the wrong kind of Muslim. That was the main reason why they had to die.
Well, some people did compare the way media treated the attacks in Paris with the attack in Beirut. But the response from some quarters in the media was to say, well, you can't blame reporters for that. It's really just people. People don't care as much about what happens in Beirut as they do what happens in Paris, you know, kind of blaming the people for it. What do you make of that?
There's a sense you get when corporate journalists are being defensive. They think that if you just say something once, that you've done your job and no one can complain about the relative amount of coverage that you give something. In comparison to the one story that this got on page A6, there were up to 20 stories a day on the Paris story, numerous stories on page 1. Clearly, the mainstream media are signaling with the amount and with the placement of the story that this is a story that you should care about. And they are equally signaling that the Beirut story is not a story you particularly should be interested in.
We can say that the attack in Beirut got less coverage than the Paris attacks, but if we compare the coverage of Paris to the coverage of the Russian plane that was bombed, that went down, that was not just a lack of attention, it was a particular quality of media attention.
Yeah, it was very striking when we went back and looked at the coverage, how the media were blaming Russia for having ISIS blow up one of its planes. The New York Times listed the bombing of the plane as among bad things that had happened to Russia as they were direct results of Mr. Putin's actions, of the Russian president. And the Times was mocking Russians because their basic reaction is to shrug and point a finger elsewhere, preferably at the West. Now, the reason that Putin was to blame for the bombing of the Russian plane by ISIS was because Russia has been bombing ISIS targets in Syria, just as France has been doing. France and Russia have been doing the exact same thing. ISIS has the same reaction, which is to attack civilians in the country that is bombing them. And in one case, this shows how reckless and foolish the Russians are. And in the other case, it barely comes up. When you're talking about France, it's very difficult to see the cause and effect relationship between the French attacking this violent group in Syria and the group striking back by attacking civilians in France. It's like it would be rude to mention that there is a consequence to French foreign policy.
It's not, of course, to justify terrorist acts. It's really just to help us understand them, to get beyond the idea that they are random and out of nowhere, but in fact, they occur in a context.
Right. It's certainly not to say that the response is justified, but to understand the world that you live in, you need to actually discuss the actual motivations of the actors in it and not pretend that their actions are completely inexplicable and can only be understood in terms of some kind of religious insanity.
So when we read coverage that says, you know, the French capital is stunned, wondering why us, you know, that's the kind of context-free coverage that you're talking about.
The French have been the primary supporters in Europe for the overthrow of the Syrian government, and that has created a state of civil war in Syria that created the opening for ISIS to have a base, to have a territory, along with the invasion of Iraq by the United States, which opened up a similar space in Iraq. And the idea that there is a connection between French intervention in the Middle East and the creation of this dangerous organization that is killing people in France is really off the table. It's not something that you can talk about because it would be callous to interfere with the grieving process by talking about French actions. And this is kind of what I mean by talking about the weaponization of grief, is that you can justify any response to a tragedy by acting as though there's no precedence for it. So the response to the violence in France can be more French violence in the Middle East, even though there are reasons to believe that the previous French violence in the Middle East started a chain of events that led to the slaughter in Paris.
This idea of putting acts in a political context and drawing some connection between what a country does and what is done to it, it's not that media never do it. They do it in some situations, don't they?
Shortly after the bombing of the Russian plane, there was an AP piece sort of speculating about whether terrorism could have been behind it. And the AP article said that if it was terrorism, quote, many Russians could reconsider the wisdom of the country's airstrikes in Syria. It's interesting that that is a possibility that is offered by corporate media to the citizens of Russia, but is not offered to the citizens of France. And in a way, if you want coverage of your government that you can actually use as a citizen, that allows you to consider the actions of your government as something that has consequences in the real world, you may be better off living under a government that the U.S. media consider to be an enemy than to live under a country that they think of as a friend.
And it would seem we're even less likely to get that kind of critical treatment of U.S. foreign policy.
No, that is the main thing that you will not get from U.S. media coverage.
We've been speaking with Jim Narikas. He's editor of FAIR's website and of our newsletter, Extra. Thanks very much, Jim Narikas, for joining us this week on Counterspin. Coverage of the upcoming UN conference on climate change has shifted to concerns about security in Paris and resulting clampdowns on activism. But before that, the conference itself was billed as pivotal on global action on the issue. Barack Obama recently declared the U.S. global leaders in the fight against climate change. But is that really true? And what should we actually expect from the conference itself? Janet Redman is director of the Climate Policy Program at the Institute for Policy Studies. She joins us now by phone from Washington, D.C. Welcome back to Counterspin, Janet Redman.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Well, your recent column on the issue, at least on Common Dreams, was headlined, "Will the Paris Climate Talks Deliver the World We Need? Not Likely." Why do you say that?
Well, I think we have to look at what the Paris talks are. I mean, there's what we want the Paris talks to do, which is to deliver an agreement between the 196 countries who signed the climate convention in order to really reduce greenhouse gas emissions, to reduce climate pollution, and provide the support to countries, particularly the poorest countries who are most impacted by climate change, both to adapt to a warming world and to move off of the dirty energy development pathways that they're right now projected to stay on. That's what we wanted to do. That's actually what we needed to do. But unfortunately, that's not what it's set up to do at this point. Right now, the conversation we're having, what we're seeing the conversation between heads of state is saying, we'll see how far we can get, we'll see what we can do based on what our circumstances are, what our economy is in the U.S., what our Congress will accept. We'll add those all together and see where that gets us. Unfortunately, we already know based on what countries have submitted as their intended contributions to this conversation, that it doesn't add up to what the science says we need in order to avoid catastrophic climate change.
Well, often the news of these conferences seems to come from the counter-narrative provided by the activists who aren't actually in the building. Is that the case with this conference as well?
Yeah, I mean, there are a couple sets of messages that I think are important for us to listen to. Certainly, there are folks inside the conference center who are part of delegations, governmental delegations, who are actively observing the various conversations that heads of state and political leaders will be having, and that's an important space. Those are the folks that are following whether there's a shall or a must or a comma or a semicolon, and all that is, of course, really important and has material consequences on the way that then our governments work on climate. But I think what's really important, as you mentioned, are the messages that are coming from outside. And while it looks at this point like we will not have the large mobilizations that were planned both before the COP and for after the summit itself, there's still going to be a lot of spaces, and folks that I've talked to are still planning on going to Paris and having those quote-unquote outside conversations. Those conversations are really focused on what we actually need. So a lot of the conversations are, how do we move past a fossil fuel powered world? How do we make sure that renewable energy is not just clean power, but democratic power? So we're shifting control out of corporate hands and into communities' hands. And then, of course, all the different ways that we need to build resilience in our communities. So not just in the energy sector, which of course is critical, but also how are we going to deal with flooding? How are we going to deal with new food systems? How are we going to make sure transportation not only works and is non-polluting, but is actually accessible by those people who have the lowest income? That's the important set of conversations that I'm excited are still going to go on at the climate conference, but oftentimes outside the official hallway.
Well, I sometimes think that media frame climate change poorly. It's presented as a political issue, you know, or as a kind of partisan issue rather than, you know, a life or death proposition.
Absolutely. I mean, what in some ways has been exciting about the rise of climate change as an issue that people are even thinking about at all is that it's really a unifying issue. Climate change impacts all of us. It impacts both the poorest of us and the wealthiest of us in multiple aspects of our lives, where we can live, the food we have access to, our safety in our homes and in our communities. But I think what's also been really important about climate change is how it raises up other issues. So, you know, putting the political issues aside and really, you know, well, we can unpack that later in terms of who's interested in making sure that there's a denial voice around. But what's been interesting about the climate conversation, I think, recently is that it's really started connecting to issues of inequality. Inequality, of course, is on all of our minds in this kind of pickety moment where here in the United States we're feeling the crunch of inequality in terms of economic inequality and racial inequality. And then globally, while GDP is rising, the disparities between the have and have-nots is also rising. So what's been interesting is how folks in the climate community are starting to think harder about not just how climate change impacts people who are in developing countries, who are in global south countries, or who are in low-income communities and communities of color, you know, more harshly first and worse, but also how the different solutions we propose. So if we propose carbon trading, which allows the dirtiest sources of pollution to keep on polluting, that actually impacts people of color and low-income communities disproportionately. And that has huge stakes here at home in the United States, where we're seeing the rollout of the Clean Power Plan and other domestic policies that are we're bringing to Paris as our contribution to the global conversation.
Well, let me just draw you out further on that, because when Barack Obama rejected the Keystone XL pipeline, he said that, you know, allowing that to happen would undercut the U.S.'s global leadership on the issue of climate change. How does that resonate with you, the idea that the U.S. is the pace car on this issue?
I think that's a tough role to sell to the rest of the world. I was part of this conversation. I was at the UN climate talks when, for the first time, the representatives of the Obama administration came to the climate talks. People were so excited that they were seeing the George W. Bush regime of climate denialism and being obstructionist in those climate talks leave. The U.S. got a standing ovation in that moment, the first time the new representative of the Obama administration arrived at the talks. So there was a lot of hope that the U.S. would actually provide leadership. Unfortunately, what we've seen is while the rhetoric has become softer, the positions haven't changed a whole heck of a lot. The U.S. is actually taking the position that we need something called pledge and review in the climate talks, which is basically the idea that in the past we've had scientists tell us, listen, we need to set a cap on climate pollution. Above this level, we're going to see really bad stuff happen. There's just too much pollution in the air. So we have to make sure that everyone, total together, doesn't go above that cap because, you know, the atmosphere doesn't really care where the greenhouse gas pollution comes from. The U.S. has said, you know, geez, that's going to be really hard. We all have different circumstances. What we should instead do is just each of us bring what we can do to the table. Let's add that up, and we're going to really hope that that equals a total that keeps us in the safe zone. And if it doesn't, we'll just keep reviewing it and trying to ramp that up. That's the worst interpretation of grassroots that I've ever heard before. So that kind of a bottom-up approach doesn't work when what's on the line is making sure we don't add so much pollution to the atmosphere that we trigger catastrophic climate change.
Yeah, it sort of seems as though it's discussed in the media as well, as though it's something that we can negotiate, when in fact the science is pretty clear about what we need to do to avoid triggering that catastrophic change.
That's right. I think what does need to be negotiated in Paris is, where does the burden fall? Whose responsibility is it to do what? So part of the big conversation there and part of the controversy there is, whose role is it to cut emissions the fastest, cut pollution the fastest? Whose responsibility is it to support those countries who are low income or have large populations of people under the poverty line to move off of dirty energy pathways? Whose responsibility is it to pay for losses and damages that have already happened, that are locked in because of the pollution that's been historically put in the atmosphere? For example, we see almost every year now, sadly, during the climate talks, a typhoon hits the Philippines. I mean, we saw the worst one 3 years ago when the climate talks were in Doha. We saw it again last year. It's devastating. That kind of loss and damage is locked in because those emissions are already in the atmosphere. The question is, who's responsible for paying for that? Is it the Philippine government? Is it the population of the Philippines who's largely low income? Or is it the countries that have been responsible for 150 years of cheap fossil fuel pollution? We've gotten rich here in the United States on cheap coal in the past. And countries like India say, hey, we've still got a huge population that doesn't have access to electricity and basic needs. So it's fair for us to want to develop in the cheapest way as well. And, of course, that means coal. So what we really need to say here in the United States to our government is, okay, India obviously can't produce the kind of global emissions that we have using the cheapest and dirtiest fossil fuel sources. So what kind of support do we need to provide, both financially and through technology, to make sure that India has the cleanest kinds of fuels to develop their and meet their electricity needs possible? So how can we be providing money, technology, resources, capacity to make sure that folks in India have access to renewable energy? And then how can we do that here at home also? Because we deserve clean power here in our communities in the U.S. as well.
We've been speaking with Janet Redman, Director of the Climate Policy Program at the Institute for Policy Studies. They're online at ips-dc.org. Thank you very much, Janet Redman, for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thanks so much for having me.
That's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. If you missed part of today's show or you'd like to hear previous shows, you can find them on FAIR's website, fair.org. The show is engineered by Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thank you for listening to Counterspin.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Are you ready for the harsh reality of our future in a hotter world? Can any of us really handle the truth? If you feel strong enough, this may be the most devastating look into where we really stand. Perhaps you remember UK writer Mark Linus stunning us with the awful changes on Earth if we warm by 5 degrees centigrade, and we may not survive 6. Many hope the climate talks in Paris can reach an agreement that will save a livable climate for all our descendants and keep global warming below 2 degrees C. But what if the national leaders are just players on a stage of illusion? What if someone told you our current levels of greenhouse gases already commit us to more than 6 degrees of global warming and over 12 meters, over 36 feet higher sea levels? And that may not be the worst of it. I'm Alex Smith with a remarkable interview from London. This is Radio EcoShock, radio you need to hear. Humans have a known tendency to either panic and hide or fight against the wrong enemy. So I try to stick to rational voices and back those up with the best scientific proof we can find. Our guest David Wasdell is one of those voices, but now he's poking big holes in mainstream hopes and illusions about saving ourselves from climate change. His latest video and paper is called Climate Dynamics: Facing the Harsh Realities of Now. David Wasdell, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Hello, Alex. Hey, it's always good to work with you on the critical issues that you raise. And to know that our discussion is being heard by a global audience that is both well-informed and passionately concerned. It's a pleasure talking with you.
Well, indeed they are. We've got a fantastic group of listeners, and they are well-informed. So I thought, just to let the listeners know what they're in for, why don't we start with a quick round of kind of yes or no questions?
Alex, that sounds like a great way to set the agenda, but, you know, I can't guarantee one-word answers. Well, let's have a go.
Okay. Number one, world leaders meet in Paris to reach an agreement to keep the world safe from dangerous climate change. Even if they agree to all the voluntary goals set by each country, will that be enough to keep climate change below 2 degrees centigrade of warming?
Absolutely not.
Right. Question two, do we have a comfortable margin of carbon we can burn and still avoid catastrophic climate change?
No. We've overshot that boundary by a massive amount.
Question three, have leading scientists modified science for politicians because the harsh realities of what we need to do are unrealistic?
Unrealistic or unacceptable. Sadly, what you're talking about is correct.
Number four, is it true that the United Nations projections of climate change, including those from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, routinely leave out important warming forces?
That is true.
Is it conceivable, David, even possible, we are setting planet Earth on a path towards heating of 8 degrees or more centigrade, or say 16 degrees Fahrenheit hotter, in the next 100 or 200 years?
Alex, that is exactly where we are headed.
And finally, if we don't wake up and act, can this generation ruin the Earth for humanity and other species for thousands of years?
Yes.
Well, there you have it, listeners. All this is part of a stunning new video lecture and paper called Climate Dynamics: Facing the Harsh Realities of Now. The presentation is by our guest, David Wasdell. He's the director of the Apollo Gaia Project. I've followed David's work for years. In December 2010, we did an interview for a Radio EcoShock show called Beyond the Tipping Point. Wasdell is well-versed in science. He keeps in touch with other scientists around the world. As an independent analyst with no institutional ties, David is free to bring out the climate science few others discuss openly with the public. Well, I've interviewed several psychologists about the human ability to lie to ourselves, but your talk goes much deeper because you're looking at vast institutional fantasies where even science is tempered by a kind of real politic. What did the famous German climate scientist John Schellenhuber tell you about that several years ago?
You know, the idea of an available carbon budget, as we call it, was introduced just prior to the 2009 Copenhagen conference. by a big think tank in Germany, the WGBU, if you translate it, the German Advisory Council on Global Change. The introduction to that report was written by Professor John Schellenhuber, who was the chair of the WBGU Council at that time. By the way, John was one of my initial colleagues at the start of the Apollo Gaia project. But in that introduction, he wrote, "This report is a compromise between what is scientifically necessary and what is politically and economically feasible." Let's do that again. "This report is a compromise between what is scientifically necessary," what the situation demands, if you like, "and what can be tolerated politically and economically." See, when key scientists put out reports that have already made that compromise, so that what they report to policymakers is already an appeasement document in terms of what the political and economic vested interests will tolerate, then in my opinion, they've already lost their authority as scientists.
But we do need to keep this carbon fantasy going. Otherwise, David, how will we drive to work or feed ourselves? Why do you think that now is a critical time to face the harsh realities about climate change?
Spot on. But you know, Alex, our patterns of work, our city design, our building architecture, our transport arrangements, food production, population growth, power generation, military strategy, political, economic, and financial institutions have all developed in the context of a virtually unlimited supply of cheap fossil energy. That age is over. Not because we've run out of fossil fuel, it's far from it, but because the collateral damage from burning the vast amounts involved has changed the very composition of the air we breathe and dramatically transformed the energy balance of our planetary home. Digging ourselves out of that hole requires a transformation the likes of which we have never before been faced by our human civilization, and it's urgent.
So let's dive into your work. I found your comparison between changes in Earth temperature and our own body temperature make it easier to understand. How do they compare?
Well, Alex, you know, the planet acts a little bit like your own body. I mean, in response to temperature. You think, if your temperature goes up by, what, 3 or 4 degrees, you're going into life-threatening stress. 5 degrees, you're probably dead. At 3.5, I don't know, possibly going into delirium. On the other hand, if your temperature drops by about 2 or 3 degrees, you're suffering hypothermia. So you and all of us in this program have a very narrow temperature scale within which to operate. Our bodies are very sensitive to small changes in temperature, and so is the planet. Let's put it this way. Just 5 degrees centigrade marks the difference between 1.5 miles of ice over Ottawa and the bustling capital city we know and love today. 5 degrees, that's all. So in that sense, global sensitivity to temperature change is extremely high. Now, from a different perspective, if you catch flu, your temperature goes up. But if you've got streptococcal meningitis, it goes up a lot further and faster. So there's a sensitivity of temperature to pathogen behavior. And there is also a sensitivity of the body to change in temperature. Two very different sorts of sensitivity. So at a planetary level, we can distinguish between the sensitivity of global climate to changes in temperature and sensitivity of global temperature to changes in carbon dioxide. Make sense?
It does. It really helps, I think, to picture this. A number of scientists, including Dr. James Hansen, have warned that the 2 degrees centigrade limit on warming is not safe at all. In fact, Hansen recently said it was crazy to think so. Do you agree?
Well, Alex, my short answer is yes. My long answer goes on a bit further. Tiny changes in planetary temperature have big effects on global climate. You can see that already with the present increase of just under 1 degree centigrade. Droughts, fires, crop failure across California and other southern states, not to mention Australia. Desertification and collapse of subsistence agriculture in sub-Saharan Africa with starvation, disease, migration, and conflict. Loss of 70% of the floating sea ice in the Arctic. The start of methane release from seabed permafrost. Disruption of the circumpolar jet stream with the weirding of weather across the northern hemisphere. And the northern part of the United States and Canada have seen all about that, with the heating on the western seaboard, intense cold on the eastern seaboard. knock-on effects of that in the monsoon behavior across Asia, with crop failure, multiple farmer suicides in northern India, devastating flooding in some areas, increase in the strength of rainfall and in the power of tropical storms with changes to their normal routes, loss of 40% of phytoplankton around the globe, damage to coral reefs and the ocean food chain. In your neck of the woods, spread of bark beetle with dieback and burn in the Canadian pine forests. The shift from carbon sink to carbon source in the Amazon rainforest with dieback wildfires and the start of the change from forest to savanna. Species extinction running at, what, about 1,000 times normal background rate? Oh, and loss of about 500 cubic kilometers per year and rising from land-based ice. 20 centimeters of sea level rise, which is about a tenth of what's already in the pipeline. Extreme water shortage in the countries around the Mediterranean with social unrest, escalating conflict, accelerating migration, and economic collapse. Alex, we are way beyond safe climate change already, at just under 1 degree. So a rise of 2 degrees centigrade would lead to over 4.5 meters, about 15 feet rise in sea level, and a multiplication of all the effects we've just been noticing today. The 2 degrees ceiling might give temporary protection to the profits from fossil energy, but it would be a catastrophic commitment for humanity as a whole. So yes, I agree with James Hansen. Setting a rise of 2 degrees centigrade as a global target and calling it safe is sheer madness.
David Wasdell, you explained developing new science on climate sensitivity. How would you define climate sensitivity to the person on the street?
Alex, thank you for asking that. It brings us right back to today and right back to the ground. You know, the very air we breathe is, what, about 4/5 nitrogen and 1/5 oxygen? That makes up pretty well 100%, doesn't it? Those gases allow light and heat radiation through in both directions without any interference. Carbon dioxide itself is a trace gas. The atmosphere contains, what, 0.025% of carbon dioxide by volume. Tiny, tiny amounts, relatively speaking. But CO2 is a greenhouse gas. It allows light in from the sun, but it blocks some of the heat energy from being radiated back out again. And along with water vapor, ozone, and methane, it acts like a thermostat. It controls the surface temperature of the planet within a range of about 35 degrees centigrade. Now, burning fossil hydrocarbons for energy, which is what we've been doing since the Brits started to dig up coal back in the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, burning fossil hydrocarbons for energy increases the concentration of atmospheric CO2. If you like, it changes the setting on the thermostat, and it pushes up the surface temperature of the planet. Now, obviously, we need to calibrate the thermostat. The measure we've chosen is a doubling of the concentration of atmospheric CO2. All right? So the question is, how much does the surface temperature of the Earth go up if we double the concentration of atmospheric carbon dioxide? The answer to that question is what we mean by climate sensitivity. So if the value is pretty low, that's okay. We can emit large quantities of carbon dioxide without pushing the temperature up too far. But if the value is much higher, then emitting even quite small amounts of carbon dioxide has a big effect on temperature. So getting that figure right is absolutely crucial for setting future strategy.
Well, that leads to my next question. How did the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC, manage to set climate sensitivity far too low?
Alex, there are two ways to tackle the problem. We can build computer models of the system and read off the resulting predictions. Alternatively, we can look in detail at the relationship between carbon dioxide concentration and associated surface temperature over millions of years of our planetary history. But here I think I need to take a step back and understand a bit more about that thermostat. The effect of change in CO2 concentration on its own is actually known pretty accurately. Trouble is, it sets off a whole host of other mechanisms, what we call feedback effect, that amplify what the change in CO2 does on its own. Now, some of those feedbacks are well known, and can be quantified and confidently used in the computer models. Others are known but cannot easily be quantified, if you like, the known unknowns. Then there's a whole set of unknown feedbacks and relationships between them all that are beyond current understanding, the unknown unknowns, if you like. Now, the set of computer models used by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC, only work with the feedback mechanisms that can be quantified. It's obvious. Inevitably, that only gives part of the picture. But in contrast, the history of the planet and its change includes, by definition, all the feedback processes, known and unknown, positive and negative, that is, amplifying or damping the process, together with all the complex interactions between them. So, computer models predict that the temperature change from doubling the concentration of CO2 would be about 3 degrees centigrade. But using the history of the actual relationship between temperature and CO2 concentration in planetary history, we find the outcome is more like 8 degrees centigrade. That's a huge difference, and it has massive strategic implications. So, you see, the reality of Earth system sensitivity is about, what, 2.5 times that comes from the partial computer models? And, oh, and by the way, then we get into politics and economics that really drive the selection of the facts. The main IPCC report clearly stated that the relationship between predicted temperature and total emissions depends on the value of climate sensitivity. That's correct. But that fact is ignored in the summary for policymakers. And, of course, in the synthesis report that is being used as the basis for the Paris conference starting next month. The low computer-generated value was selected as the basis for strategy against strong academic advice. But, you know, that decision clearly fits the economic agenda of the fossil industry, and I suppose that's what largely controls the political position. You could say it's an example of policy-selected climate science, rather than what we really need, which is science-directed climate policy.
I suppose this means that a smaller amount of carbon dioxide and a lesser rise in global mean temperature will do much more damage than we thought. Is that it?
You're spot on, mate.
Listeners, you're tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with my guest, Dr. David Wasdell. We're talking about the harsh realities of now, a new presentation that he's brought out about the realities of climate change. A key part of your presentation, well shown in simple graphs, are the layers of feedbacks that amplify the measurements of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. David, could you take some time now to tell us about that? Let's start with the so-called fast feedbacks or Charney feedbacks.
Wow. Alex, it sounds like you're asking for a sort of mini tutorial at this point. Is that okay?
That's exactly what we need, yes.
Okay, well, let's have a go. Hang in here. In order to maintain the energy balance of the Earth, the average surface temperature of the planet has to change by 1 degree centigrade to compensate for about 3.8 watts per square meter of radiant energy that is blocked by change in the greenhouse effect. Got it? Now, if the temperature changed by 5 degrees between the depth of the last ice age and the pre-industrial benchmark, 5 degrees, then it means that 5 times 3.8 watts, 19 watts per square meter, has been blocked because of change in the greenhouse effect and the change in the reflectivity of the planet from changes in the ice fields and so on during that period. 19 watts per square meter. Let's keep that in mind. So what are the elements that gave rise to that change? I'm going to introduce them in sort of layers. I'm going to start with change in solar energy. Then I'm going to add the contribution of carbon dioxide on its own. Then I'll look at the effects of the fast feedbacks, the Charney sensitivity. Explore that later. That's going to be followed by the carbon cycle feedbacks, which we call the Hadley sensitivity, the ice sheet dynamics, named after Jim Hansen, and finally, the full Earth system sensitivity, which includes all the amplifying processes. Okay, let's start. To start with, then, there's a change of about 0.5 watt per square meter in solar energy received during this time, because of the change in the shape of the Earth's orbit around the Sun. It's not a lot. That leaves us about 18.5 watts. Keep going. Change in the concentration of carbon dioxide contributed, 2.3 watts per square meter during that period? But the Earth system amplifies the effect of carbon dioxide. So if you just look at the contribution from CO2 on its own, we still have to account for about 84% of the change in the planetary behavior. Okay, let's go on. Next, we're putting in the effects of the fast feedback response. We call it the Charney sensitivity, so-called because a guy called Jule Charney was the chair of the original committee that worked on this back in, 1979, I think. These fast feedbacks are, firstly, atmospheric water vapor. It's a powerful greenhouse gas, and it increases almost instantaneously with rising temperature. Then cloud behavior changes and increases the feedback. Clouds reflect sunlight back into space. They also reflect infrared energy, the heat energy, back down towards the surface of the Earth. So their behavior goes in two ways. One is a negative feedback, one is a positive feedback. But the amplifying feedback wins. So it's a net amplifier. Thirdly, the area of floating sea ice decreases with rising temperature, and that reduces the reflection of solar energy, so we absorb more energy with rising temperature. These three feedbacks come into action as soon as temperature starts to change. That's why they're called fast feedback. Though, mind you, the resulting heating is very slow. They add about, 5 watts per square meter during this period. That still leaves 60%, 58% roughly, still unaccounted for. Oh, by the way, did you know the current set of climate models, the one used as the basis for the fifth assessment report of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, deals only with these fast feedbacks? It's amazing to many people. But workgroups 2 and 3 of that report, together with all the subsequent analysis and reports prepared in the run-up to Paris Climate Conference, all share this same methodological dependency. They all use an understanding of climate feedback dynamics that falls short of reality by about 60%. But they persist in using that inappropriate figure as the basis of the international negotiations in Paris. Let's move on. Some of the more sophisticated supercomputer models, like the UK Hadley Centre, which is why we use the word Hadley feedback, Hadley sensitivity, also include some of the effects of the carbon cycle feedbacks, which add about another 3 1/3 watts to the per square metre. But, you know, we're still 41% short of the 19 watts per square metre we need to balance the energy budget. Oh, by the way, the carbon cycle feedbacks are not taken into account in the IPCC advice to policymakers. They're noted, of course, in the main body of the report, but left out in the political advice. And that situation reflects a long-standing policy in the work of the IPCC. It tends to focus on the output from the most basic computer models, while the more sophisticated ones are seen as like outliers, and they tend to be ignored. Mind you, using non-modeled historical data, James Hansen, until recently director at NASA's GISS institution, has included long-term ice dynamics. That's the changing reflection from the big land-based ice sheets. Obviously, as the ice sheets melt, they don't reflect the sunlight back, so the Earth heats faster, and that feedback adds another 3.6 watts per square meter. Hey, but you know, even Hansen's work is still about 22% short of the target. So we've got a gap. The dynamics of the planet as a whole, with all its feedbacks, known and unknown, and all their interaction, adds a final 4.1 watts per square meter to the total. And that completes the change of 19 watts per square meter between the depth of the Ice Age and the pre-industrial benchmark. That's the figure we need to be working with in making strategic policies. And it's the ground of what we've come to term the full Earth system sensitivity.
That was a lot, and I'm hoping listeners will download this as a podcast as well and re-listen to that, because I think that's the way to go. And you can get it from my blog at ecoshock.info, the Wednesday of the week that this is broadcast.
And by the way, Alex, you can also get it on the Apollo Gaia website, both as a PDF printout and also as a full video. Did you know that?
Yes. So, all right. So where do listeners go to get that?
Well, we'll probably give that at the end, but it goes on apollo-gaia.org and then goes straight to the first big title on the homepage, which is called Climate Dynamics, Facing the Harsh Realities of Now.
Okay, and I recommend that listeners do that. But first, I'd like to backtrack a little bit into something you just talked about. Please explain a little bit about the carbon cycle feedbacks.
Carbon cycle. Well, as the concentration of carbon dioxide goes up in the atmosphere, many trees and plants go, oh, yippee, this is sort of atmospheric food. And they start to grow a bit faster and absorb more of the CO2. So as the concentration of CO2 goes up and the temperature goes up, we begin to see more CO2 absorbed. But then they get a bit sick of that, and they say, this is too rich. And as the CO2 goes up more, the little stomata on the back of the leaves start to shrink and not so many of them open, and the trees and the plants take in less CO2. So instead of being a growing sink of carbon in the atmosphere, they become a net source of carbon in the atmosphere. And that's pretty critical. There are many, many other carbon feedbacks. For instance, plankton. Plankton absorb a lot of carbon dioxide from the atmosphere and turn it into various chemicals in their metabolism. But as the carbon concentration goes up, the phytoplankton don't like the acidity of the resulting ocean surface concentrations. And that damages the plankton. And we've already lost quite a lot of that from around the planet. That means they don't absorb so much carbon from the atmosphere. That increases, therefore, the amount of carbon that stays in the atmosphere. There are a host of little carbon feedbacks, some of them big, some of them small, some of them fast, some of them slow. And Hadley has had a good shot at dealing with some of those. It's probably the best model in the world that does that.
So you say the whole collection of feedbacks amplify the simple effect of adding carbon to the atmosphere by a factor of 8. What does that really mean?
Well, as we've seen, the effect of changing the concentration of CO2 on its own is quite small. But change in temperature it initiates actually sets off a great range of feedback mechanisms, which increase its power by a factor of about 8. It's a bit like feeding a small signal from a microphone into the amplifier of a PA system. That increases the power of the signal and feeds it out into a large auditorium. Does that help?
Yes, I think that's so important to understand, and I didn't really grasp that before going through your paper. So please tell us what doubling CO2 from 280 parts per million, which it was in pre-industrial times, to 560 parts per million, which could happen in the near future, what does that produce as we include each stage of those feedbacks?
Well, I'll do my best. Moving from the specific example of change since the last ice age, we can derive the value of the more generalized climate sensitivity. That's the equilibrium change in average surface temperature of the planet following a doubling of the concentration of atmospheric CO2. Now then, the temperature change required to compensate for the effect of doubling CO2 concentration on its own is about 0.97 of a degree, almost 1 degree centigrade. Okay. Climate sensitivity, when only the fast feedbacks are taken into consideration, puts that up to 3 degrees. When you include the effects of the carbon cycle feedbacks, the sensitivity value goes up to 4.5 degrees as a result of just doubling the CO2. You add in the contribution from the ice sheet dynamics, and that goes up to 6 degrees for the value of climate sensitivity. While the sensitivity value representing the equilibrium dynamics of the Earth as a whole stands at 7.8 degrees following a doubling of CO2. Though I've got a caveat here, which I think is a bit scary. Please note, this figure is derived from slow and close to equilibrium conditions of change in the whole series of glacial interglacial periods stretching back over 1 million years. And it may be too low in the current conditions of the Anthropocene. So the figure I'm using in this paper is probably a bit conservative rather than way out and scary. Well, it's still scary, but it's not way out. You know, if you're working with computer models using only fast feedbacks, you'd predict that 2 degrees centigrade would be achieved at around 440 parts per million of CO2 in the atmosphere. However, if you use, as you really must, the full Earth system sensitivity, then at 440 parts per million, you're going to be looking at about 5 degrees centigrade of change, not 2. You see, I keep reminding you, the computer simulation, inadequate and partial though it may be, is what is still being fed into the process of strategic policy making, on this assumption that the temperature change is only 2 degrees for a concentration of 440 parts per million of CO2. It's an illusion, Alex.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Our guest is David Wasdell from London, England. All right. This is a bit frightening because I remember when Mark Linus wrote his book, What Would Happen at 5 Degrees and What Would Happen at 6, and it looks like we're already committed to 5 or 6 degrees. We'll get to that. Okay, so what is the eventual warming, or as you say, the implicit temperature we can expect from our current level of 400 parts per million carbon dioxide in the atmosphere?
Right. Well, we're just about hitting the 400 parts per million this year, aren't we? It's an extraordinary level to be going above. I don't think many people thought we'd get there that fast. Well, Alex, I've introduced the concept of implicit temperature change as a way of addressing the question, what is the eventual change in temperature to be expected as a result of any specific level of rise in the concentration of atmospheric CO2? It kind of collapses the time dimension and says, well, you know, what we've done is this, the response is going to be that. So today, at 400 parts a million, we have an implicit temperature increase of about 4 degrees centigrade in the pipeline as a result of current concentrations of carbon dioxide. That's pretty clear. But we've also emitted nitrous oxide and ozone and methane and chlorofluorocarbons and hydrofluorocarbons and about 15 other very trace but powerful greenhouse gases from our global use of chemistry. And if you add the effects of all those non-CO2 greenhouse gases together, then there's about 480 parts per million of carbon dioxide equivalent, as we call it, already in the atmosphere. It's adding about 54% to the effects of the carbon dioxide and its feedbacks on their own. So the implicit temperature increase from the full amount of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere today is about 6.2 degrees centigrade. When it's all worked through to equilibrium, it could take a long time, but that's the implicit change in temperature for which we are now responsible.
But that is fantastic. Are you really saying we're not just doomed to go past the supposed 2-degree safety barrier, which isn't safe, but we are already committed to over 6 degrees centigrade of warming eventually, just with our current greenhouse gases in the atmosphere?
Absolutely correct, Alex, except, and I do need to say that, we're only doomed, as you put it, and I'm not a doom monger, we're only doomed if we decide to do nothing about it. Let's keep that right on the top of our agenda.
Well, leading from that, I think you will agree there's a huge gap, a kind of failure of the human mind that stops us from facing realities like this and taking action to save ourselves. You've called it dynamic inertia, and that acts like a trap in our experience. It fools people into thinking things aren't so bad, the climate disruption must be a long way off. How does inertia work in the world's climate system?
You know, human beings, and that's us, have evolved to react to immediate threat. You know, you see a saber-toothed tiger coming out from the jungle and you go, yow, run, at least faster than the person behind you. I remember being asked what would have to happen to motivate adequate response at a seminar I was at in Seattle. My answer was, if that kind of event occurred, it would already be far too late to take effective action. You see, the inertia of the Earth system is massive. Alex, the observed effects lag far behind the already applied causes. There's a huge time lag. And I think that behavior is ever so apparent when we note implicit temperature change caused by current cumulative emissions stands at 6.2 degrees centigrade, but observed temperature change has only registered, what, about 0.85 of a degree centigrade? Could go up to 1 degree this year with the big El Nino in the Pacific. So explicit observed change stands, what, at about 13, 14% of the implicit eventual change. Over 86% of implicit temperature change is still in the pipeline. Wow. And by the way, sea level change is much harder. Sea level change is sort of subject to a double inertia, isn't it? In terms of what temperature, observed effects lag massively behind applied cause. But in terms of sea level change, the observed temperature change itself, that's the observed temperature change itself, acts as cause. And the change in sea level lags massively behind the change in observed temperature change. And the temperature change lags, in turn, massively behind implicit change in temperature. And that is driven by the fundamental cause of systems change, namely our total cumulative human-driven carbon emissions. Let's put this quantitatively. Observed temperature change of 0.85 degrees centigrade implies a sea level rise of 2 meters. That's what's in the pipeline now, of which only 20 centimeters, that's about 10%, has actually occurred so far. Then think, 0.85 of a degree centigrade is only about 14% of currently implicit temperature change. So observed rise in global sea level of just 20 centimeters represents just under 1.5% of the current implicit change in global sea level. Over 98% of implicit rise in sea level is still to come. I want to just go do a bit of an aside here, Alex, may I? Yeah. You know, it's imperative that the implicit changes, what we're really in for, are taken as the basis for current decision-making. I sometimes say, you know, we have to stand at the bar of history and say, we knew the implicit change resulting from what we are doing to the planet is this. Yes, we'd only observed a tiny amount of it, but we knew this lot was coming and was inherent in what we had done. Do we really dare to stand at the bar of history and say, we knew these levels of temperature change, these levels of sea level change, were going to be the outcome of our strategic decision-making? And yet, in the moment, we refuse to take them into account? It's crazy.
All right, let's move ahead further into the implicit rising seas. We have a huge impact with an even bigger delay built in. I'm talking about rising sea levels, and some of my scientific guests say that rising seas may have even more impact on human civilization than rising temperatures. How do you see rising seas reshaping the geography of the world?
You know, I think that's one of the most important risks we face, to be honest. There's a series of recent studies that provided a pretty reasonable, robust rule of thumb that says about 2.3 meters of eventual change in global sea level will occur for each 1 degree change in average global surface temperature. What's 2.3 meters in about 7 feet, I suppose, is it? You know, if the current implicit change in global surface temperature, which stands at 6.2 degrees, then the current implicit change in sea level stands at 14.25 meters, of which only 20 centimeters has been observed to date. Wow, we're going to have a rise in sea level. Let's put a barrier around the seaward front of Venice that'll protect Venice from about 1 meter of sea level change. How unrealistic is that? The so-called safe ceiling of a rise of 2 degrees would lead to an increase of 4.6 meters of sea level. Doesn't sound safe to me. And by the way, if cumulative total emissions could not be reduced below the level to which the current set of promises put up for the Paris conference would lead, then the implicit increase in average global surface temperature will be just over 10 degrees centigrade, not 4, as predicted by the Intergovernmental Panel, and that would be reflected in an implicit rise in global sea level of over 23 meters. Alex, that's the best that's on the table for the Paris Climate Conference.
You're talking about the height of tall buildings.
Yeah.
Oh, Oh, this isn't good. So, David Wasdell, is there a way to know the pace and the destination of these implicit sea level rise? Do we know how fast, really know how fast it will come?
Well, historically, you know, the pace of ice melt, and therefore the change in sea level, has danced in tune with the multi-thousand-year timescales reflecting astronomical changes in orbital shape and the tilt and wobble of the Earth's axis of rotation. It's been very slow. Today, the pace of ice melt is driven by rapid increase in global temperature, not slow astronomical change. It's about 2,500 times the astronomical pace. So we have absolutely no historical precedent by which to predict the timing and the rate of sea level change. It's likely to be exponential. The faster it goes, the faster it goes, tiddly-pom, and much more rapid than current models suggest. So while, for instance, the IPCC may be looking at about 65 centimeters by the end of the century, some of our scientists are saying it could be 3 or 4 meters by the end of the century. And if the rate of change in temperature really takes off, and it's meant to, by all accounts, then it could be more than that by the end of the century. I don't like it.
Meanwhile, at various conferences, in the business press and in scientific circles, there's been a lot of effort to work out how much more carbon we can still burn in the form of oil, gas, and coal, and still remain below this 2-degree warming limit. We've talked about how silly that is in a way and how dangerous that is. And no doubt diplomats at the Paris conference will still talk about this carbon budget. How much of a budget do we really have left?
Or do we have any at all? That's the $64 trillion question, isn't it? Well, let's start like this. At present, CO2 concentration stands at 400 parts per million. Okay, we know that. If it's thought to be safe to go up to 440 parts per million, then we've got a good budget to play with, haven't we? So there's still plenty of room in what I call the skyfill site. However, if we don't depend on the inadequate computer models and instead, as we really should, apply the full Earth system sensitivity, then we are already committed to passing, or at least we were already committed to passing the 2-degree ceiling when CO2 concentration stood at, wait for it, 334 parts per million. That's over 60 parts per million less than the current concentration. It was back in 1978. So we've already overspent the budget, as they call it, by a huge amount. We're bankrupt. You getting the picture?
David, how did you work out your real carbon budget, and what do you base these calculations on?
Okay, I'll be as brief as I can, Alex. Let me explain available carbon budget like this. If we estimate temperature impact of what we've already emitted is, say, X degrees centigrade, and we need to keep the increase to not more than 2, then if we estimate between X and 2 there's still significant space in the skyfill site, then that is the budget. How much more can we dump in the skyfill site and be safe? But, you know, once that available carbon budget is established, we have one almighty punch-up in the international community. And this is the process of the huge COP conferences. You know, some are saying, look, we've got the right to emit. No, we have the right to emit. This is not equitable or just. We want differentiated responsibilities. Look at the history of who has put out what. Look at our needs. We are developing countries. Oh, we depend for our survival on income from fossil industries. You can't take that away from us. Look at sea level rise. We've lost our livelihood. We've got nowhere to live. So this group of conflicted interests is trying to wrangle over how to spend an assumed budget, which probably doesn't exist. Okay, so how do you calculate available carbon budget? Well, here's a summary. There's a lot in my video and the PDF, but this is about 4 or 5 lines of summary. We know pretty accurately how much carbon has been emitted since the start of the Industrial Revolution. Okay? That gives us a figure for the implicit temperature increase. If we stick to inadequate computer values for climate sensitivity, then the IPCC estimates a remaining carbon budget of, what, about 250 gigatons of carbon before we pass the 2-degree boundary? using the full Earth system sensitivity shows we've overshot that boundary by, what, 323 gigatons of carbon? We've probably got to put the ceiling back from 2 degrees to 1 degree, and that increases the overshot, the bankruptcy, to a total of 464 gigatons of carbon. And even that doesn't take into account non-CO2 greenhouse gases that add about 54% to the effects of CO2 emissions. So there's a way there, and it's much more detailedly set out in the resources you have available. Let's go on.
All right, that's at apollo-gaia.org. You can watch the full video and really tune into the science of this. So I do want to ask you this rather harsh question because I think it could become a reality. What has to happen for the world to warm a full 10 degrees centigrade?
We have to give up dealing with the problem is the first answer. National promises, the independent nationally determined contributions, or INDCs as they're called, concerning reductions in CO2 emissions, have all been tabled ahead of COP21 in Paris. Alex, those promises look like pushing us up to about 700 parts per million by the end of the century, if they're implemented. And I guess there's no guarantee about that whatsoever. Business as usual, what we're literally committed to at the moment, is driving us towards more like 800 or 900 parts per million up there. And if we can't improve the levels of promised emissions reduction, then IPCC says, hey, we might hit 4 degrees centigrade using its low value for sensitivity. But if we use the full Earth system sensitivity, which we really should be doing by now, to examine the way the climate behaves at a level of 700 parts per million, we're not looking at around 4 degrees. We're looking at an increase of more like 10 degrees as a result of the best promises on the table in Paris. That's twice the temperature shift between the depth of the last ice age and the pre-industrial benchmark. And if we're not able to cut back on our current business-as-usual behavior, then temperature rise increases to more like 12 or even 15 degrees. And by the way, two or three times that amount in the Arctic. Alex, that means goodbye all the ice on Earth. Welcome to something like 90 feet of sea level rise when all of the Greenland ice cap and the whole of Antarctica melts at this level. Human civilization would have collapsed ages before we reached that. London and New York would be underwater, and so would a lot more of the world.
Now, you haven't left it at that. You have some advice on strategy and on stabilization. I'd like to get to that. A small group of scientists will advise UK Prime Minister David Cameron and all the world leaders on what to say at the Paris COP21 Climate Summit in December 2015. If you wrote that report for leaders, what strategy would you recommend?
Wow, some responsibility. Hey, this whole presentation was actually conceived at an event organized by the Global Leaders Academy way back in spring this year. I think the task of leadership in this context is truly awesome. Alex, you referred to world leaders attending the Paris summit, but you know, they attend in their role as national representatives. And however well-intentioned the wording of the final communique, each leader is present at that conference to fight for the best interests of the nation they represent. It's a struggle group. In a sense, they're fighting over limited resources and trying to minimize threats to national interests. True global leadership steps up a level. It has to. It has to recognize the overall planetary scale of the crisis, the resolution of which requires collaboration to triumph over competition. National interest bows to the overarching requirements of global survival, the achievement of which is ultimately in the best interest of each and every one of the nation states involved. I think maybe nation states evolving is also critical here, don't you? Yeah. Freudian slips sometimes tell us a lot. But to return, look, you have a request for a scientific briefing for those leaders. Now, at the moment, every report, every paper being prepared and presented ahead of the Paris conference has a threefold mantra. One, 2 degrees ceiling. Two, budget approach to negotiations. Three, strategy of goal achievement by reduction of carbon emissions. And the pressure to collude with that party line is phenomenal. You dare step out of line. Can I say this? any agreement reached in Paris on those terms would be a strategic disaster. It would commit humanity to a course of action that would guarantee catastrophic climate change, with all the unmanageable consequences that would involve. And, Alex, there is also profound pressure to determine strategic response by reference to currently observed changes in the global climate system. That's grossly inadequate as an approach when we're dealing with any complex system subject to the kind of massive time delays between cause and effect that we've already noted. So strategic response must be ordered by the scale of implicit change in system behavior rather than by reaction to minor systems already presenting themselves for observation. So what are the conclusions? And this is how I'd put them in the report. It's now abundantly clear that limiting temperature change to 2 degrees cannot be achieved by emissions reductions on their own. There is no available carbon budget. It's already massively overspent. We're bankrupt even for the 2-degree centigrade target. Moreover, the 2-degree centigrade target has been set far too high. It's far too dangerous. It must be reduced from 2 through 1.5 to 1 at the very most, and possibly even further, if we're going to avoid dangerous climate change and so conform with the globally agreed terms of the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change. Yes, emissions reduction is a necessary but not sufficient step towards climate stabilization. In addition, it's now imperative to draw down much of the stock of emitted greenhouse gases already in the atmosphere. What does that mean? Well, it means we've got to move beyond reduced emissions and a low-carbon economy, pass through and beyond the zero-carbon economy, and then achieve a substantial carbon drawdown economy at a global level and within the shortest possible time frame. It's a kind of demand that moves us beyond the current one-dimensional strategy of emissions reduction to an integrated two-dimensional strategy that also includes stock reduction. I think that would be the sort of gist of the report. Whether any of the leaders would be able to understand it and take it seriously in the light of the huge pressure on them is another matter altogether.
Well, I wish we had time to go through your 5-step program to stabilize the climate. I don't think that we do. I'm going to have to ask listeners to go to your video and to read your PDF document that's available on your website to get those 5 steps, because as you can tell, listeners, he's made a lot of sense so far, and the 5 steps I think would do it. But I'd like to close out a little bit with the fact that you do have a dream of an alternative civilization for humanity. What is the new source of power that you think can carry us through?
Well, we have to shift from using an energy source that requires drawing out of oxygen from the atmosphere and dumps the waste products back into the atmosphere. And that means we're going to have to face the harsh realities of a transition from fossil energy as a driver of our global civilization to the clean solar energy that is available. Alex, it's time to say no to the dark and toxic energy of the underworld. And it's time to say yes and welcome to the pure and sustainable energy of light. It's a bit poetic, this, isn't it? Photodynamics can outpower, outpace, out-resource, and be cheaper than any amount of energy we get from fossil resources. It's time to break out of our bondage to the past. It's time to embrace the freedom of the sun. It's time to usher in the dawn of solar society. By the way, never in the course of human history have so many been trapped in economic bondage to so few. So the breakout is a transformation. And I think that transition from fossil dependency to solar dependency is an extraordinary shift for our whole species. It's a bit like, you know, introducing photosynthesis in the evolution of plants, which could then take solar energy and transform base chemicals into more complex molecules. But today, we are able to take light energy and transform it directly into electricity, power, heat, and light. It's a kind of metamorphosis. I don't see us caught in the death throes of civilization, Alex, merely the demise of an inappropriate mode of civilization. I think we're really experiencing the birth pangs of a new form of humanity. You know, wasn't it that English poet T.S. Eliot who wrote, "Mankind cannot tolerate very much reality"? And time poverty is one of the excuses we use to mask our fear. But thankfully, there's a rapidly growing movement of people around the world who are finding the courage to face the harsh realities of now. And I suppose the video is becoming a catalyst for that momentum. The response has been overwhelming. So it gives me a courage to share a dream of the future. And I'd like to finish with that. It goes something like this, Alex. I have a dream that humanity will break out of its state of denial and find the courage to face the harsh realities of now. I have a dream that as a species, we will look back on this current crisis and celebrate the solutions we were able to put in place and say with pride, that was humanity's finest hour. Alex, that's the dream. Our task is to make the dream come true.
Listeners, you can go to apollo-gaia.org. That's Apollo with one P and two L's and a dash and Gaia, G-A-I-A.org, to watch this free video with David Wasdell. Please spend the time, learn. It may be the most important hour you will spend this month or maybe this year. You can also download the free summary of the video. And of course, I'll put links in my own show blog published every Wednesday at ecoshock.info. Or you can just Google Face the Harsh Realities of Now, and David's webpage comes right up at the top of the pile. David Wasdell, thank you so much for taking the time to explain this for all of us.
Alex, thank you so much for the opportunity. Go well.
I'm Alex Smith, reporting for Radio EcoShock. All I can tell you is that I've heard from over 100 previous scientists interviewed on Radio EcoShock the evidence that David Wasdell adds up for us in this talk. It's sobering, depressing, and maybe, yes, liberating. We can only go forward, if we can, when we know where we are right now. Please help get this message out widely. Share David's video link, this program, your own thoughts and activism. You know, giving up is not an option. I'm your dedicated friend, Alex Smith. My thanks to all those who reached out to support Radio EcoShock this week, the people who tweet and Facebook further than I can. Thank you for being brave enough to listen, and let's meet again next week.
Can work for years and years, you're always on the go. You never take a minute off, too busy making dough. Someday you say you'll have your fun when you're a millionaire. Imagine all the fun you'll have in your old rocking chair.
Enjoy yourself. Later than you think. Enjoy yourself while you're still in the pink. The years go by as quickly as a wink. Enjoy yourself, enjoy yourself. It's later than you think.
What I have to tell is a very grim story indeed.
But it does require that we have a moratorium on any new coal-fired power plants, and over the next 25 to 30 years, we're going to have to phase out those that exist.
What if you knew that every time you flip on your light switch, a mountaintop in West Virginia just blows up?
Enjoy yourself, it's later than you
And you're listening to Unusual Sources here on 93.3 CFMU FM, special double episode this week. That's right. You can listen to us even past the 6 o'clock mark. We've got lots to tell you, lots to show you, lots to catch up on, and live new interviews. I'm glad, in fact, today we're going to be starting out with Eve Engler. Of course, he's the noted Canadian author and journalist, frequent guest on our program, and he's written an article very recently about Canada's arms exports. So, Eve, thanks very much for being on the program with us today.
Thanks for having me, buddy.
Great. You know, I should tell our listeners that your article is called Canada's Flourishing Arms Trade with Middle East Dictatorships. That's Canada's Flourishing Arms Trade with Middle East Dictatorships. And so article that I caught was on Dissident Voice. It's probably been published elsewhere. I know that last year, 2014, the government of Canada had announced the largest ever arms export agreement in the Middle East. And we have some multi-billion dollar partnerships here. I guess the biggest one, Eve, I guess it's going to some democratic country that's setting a positive example for the region, presumably. So who's our partner and customer primarily for all these weapons?
Maybe surprisingly or not surprisingly, depending on how much you know about Canadian foreign policy, it is not a force for you know, democratic development or progressive change or most of what the vast majority of Canadians would consider to be progressive values or their values. It's actually Saudi Arabia, which is happens to be one of the most repressive governments in the world, both internally and in the region, an incredibly negative force with regards to the Arab democracy movements that flourished in 2011. And basically, the Canadian government, the Harper government specifically, has really ramped up sales and announced a $15 billion or $14.8 billion light armored vehicle sale. Not just a sale, but also a long-term agreement to maintain and I think also train Saudi military, National Guard, actually. It's all quite secretive. But this is the biggest arms deal that Canada has ever signed, a single arms deal in the history of this country. And it's not just between General Dynamics Canada. Most of the weapons were the light armored vehicles will be built in London, Ontario, at the General Dynamics factory there. But it's actually via the Canadian Commercial Corporation, which is a crown corporation where the government appoints the board, and it has become a much more aggressively involved in the global arms trade and particularly in the Middle East, and particularly with the monarchies, Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, and other monarchies over the region that are viewed as Canadian regimes that are viewed as sympathetic to Canada's geopolitical outlook in the region.
Makes you wonder what our geopolitical outlook is, but you know, you can speculate as to how some of these regimes will use the equipment, but we don't need to speculate. We actually know, because it's my understanding Saudi Arabia did invade Bahrain. They quashed protest there using, in fact, the very type of LAV that Canada sells them, if I understand correctly.
That's again, it's a little bit hard to be absolutely 100% sure of that, but there are images of Saudi light armored vehicles entering Bahrain in 2011 in response to the pro-democracy demonstrations against a 200-plus-year monarchy in Bahrain, and the Canada has previously sold light armored vehicles to the Saudis. This goes back, it's not just the Harper government, it goes back into the early 90s, the Khrechian government. In 2009, also, the Harper government okayed export licenses for up to $4 billion in sales. Again, this was presumed to be light armored vehicles to Saudi Arabia. So yes, we don't need to speculate. We know what these weapons will be used for. Two things: they'll be used for the National Guard in terms of controlling internal dissent, the Saudi National Guard, and they will be used to express Saudi power in the region, and that's a power that is very much antagonistic to the Middle East, to people having a voice, democratic voice to the region really sort of advancing and breaking free of foreign domination. Saudi Arabia is a bulwark of conservatism and really of tied into, it's a U.S.-led empire in the region. So we know what they're going to be used for. We also know this is some big profits for some of the friends of the conservative government. So any consequences for human rights violations are very much secondary to the profit question and the geopolitical support for Saudi Arabia.
Yeah, it's all very interesting because our media was celebrating the Arab Spring, and I remember a lot of television coverage, but they weren't so big on telling us about, when Saudi Arabia was using armored vehicles against civilians. And when that kind of thing happens, usually there's a lot of outrage and there's calls to sanction a government that does that. But of course, instead, we're entering into the largest arms deal in history to provide them with the same type of vehicles and equipment they use against civilians. And as you point out, it's not just Saudi Arabia. So we're becoming a bigger player in the global arms market. I understand there's a Canadian military colonel overseeing one of those large transactions. In fact, according to your article, I think Ottawa sent a naval frigate, the HMCS Toronto, to the UAE as part of one of those weapons exhibitions.
Yep, they did. And then the IDEX, which is considered the biggest weapons fair in the Middle East, is actually taking place in a few weeks now. And already La Presse is just reporting that the Canadian, the CATSI, the arms lobbyist group in Canada, is being funded in part by Canadian taxpayers, and that's what has happened previously. So the arms dealers who are going to the Middle East to seek out sales are receiving part of their travel costs and fees for these events paid for by Canadian taxpayers. Also the government ministers have been repeatedly going to Saudi Arabia. It's like 8 or 9 conservative ministers who have visited Saudi Arabia. And what they're doing, of course, is trying to seek, it's often a trade minister, at VAST, trying to seek, more agreements, contracts for Canadian businesses, both in the, in the arms industry most prominently, but also companies like, SNC-Lavalin and Bombardier who have had, billions of dollars in contracts in recent years with Saudi Arabia. It's an aggressive policy that everything from some Canadian tax dollars to Canadian soldiers who train the Saudis on this equipment to Canadian naval frigates being sent there as part of including Saudi fighter pilots for the first time training in Canada at the big NATO Air Force training in Moose Jaw, Saskatchewan. So it's a really aggressive policy. This is not just sort of some business, you know, some Canadian business that happens to come across a desire by Saudi Arabia for light armored vehicles, but this is very aggressive. All of different elements of Canadian foreign policy and trade departments getting behind ramping up military sales to the most repressive government in the region.
I guess you could say Harper's vision of foreign policy corresponds in some way to a vision for Canada. You have the support for these repressive monarchies in the Middle East, and our relation with them is through billions of dollars in weapons, which are used for all sorts of dubious purposes. And over here, you build this constellation or this conglomeration where you have, a naval frigate, naval personnel acting as part of an advertising campaign for Canadian equipment, and the manufacturers work closely with the government to ensure that these kinds of deals are negotiated internationally.
For sure. There, I mean, it's aggressive. The one element, a couple years ago, I wrote a piece on this topic of a sort of side part of what you, the question you just asked about Harper's support for monarchy, because of course people must probably remember that the Harper government added the name Royal to the Canadian Air Force's name, which had been taken out 40 or 50 years ago, and how they've really gone out of their way to ramp up the sort of monarchist tradition in this country with the, you know, the British monarchy, and so how it was sort of there's a parallel between their support for monarchies in the Middle East and their desire to reclaim the monarchist kind of symbolism in this country. I'm not sure how far I would go with that being the what's driving things, but I think there is some small element there of a deference to authority or power that the monarchist symbol, be it the British monarchy or the Saudi monarchy, that I think impresses the current government in Ottawa.
Indeed, and I guess it means something for Canadian values abroad. I mean, when people used to see a maple leaf, they would think of Canada and our weather and our tourists and things like that. And I guess now maybe when they see a maple leaf, they'll think of an armored vehicle shooting at their friends or something like that. Yes, it is unfortunate, but I'm glad you are keeping watch on these things. There's a lot of news stories and there's a lot of crap floating around, but you happen to get to the very most important parts, which is how our government sees itself and its role in the world and the kind of arrangements it makes, the kind of large, significant, policy-defining arrangements it makes. So I thank you very much for cutting through all the fog and bringing us this kind of coverage. So I was lucky to catch that article on Dissident Voice. You may not know offhand where else it was published, but where can people get archives or access to your articles like this one?
Well, this one was on rabble.ca as well, but also on my website, evingler.com. Most of my articles eventually are archived there, and I know that the most of the libraries in Hamilton and in the area have copies of The Ugly Canadian and other of my books that have been published on Canadian foreign policy.
That's right, and I'll announce your latest one shortly. Well, anyway, Eve, thanks very much for bringing us this information, and thanks for being on the program with us today.
Thanks for having me.
Bye-bye. And that is Canadian author and activist Eve Engler. He is co-author of the recently released New Communist Manifesto, Workers of the World, It Really Is Time to Unite, which is a rewriting of the original designed to spark debate about new direction for the left and the union movement. You can actually find more information about that at www.newcommunist.com. Bit of an alternate spelling of the word there. We'll be right back.
Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Between the Lines.
Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Vijay Prashad, professor of international studies and author, who discusses the shocking terrorist attacks in Paris, the goals of the perpetrators, and policy options to diminish future cycles of violence. Jacqueline Patterson of the NAACP's Environmental and Climate Justice Program, who talks about the continuing effort to make the climate movement more inclusive of communities of color. And Matt Dos Santos of the ACLU of Oregon, who examines the recent revelation that the Oregon Department of Justice had covertly surveilled state residents who used the Black Lives Matter hashtag in their Twitter feeds. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
On the fifth anniversary of her release from house arrest, pro-democracy leader Aung San Suu Kyi and her party, the National League for Democracy, or NLD, won a majority of seats in Myanmar's, formerly Burma's, parliament and the right to form a new government. Myanmar's 2008 constitution, written by the military, bars Suu Kyi from becoming president, but the democracy crusader insists, as party leader, she will be above the president. The NLD swept out the ruling party of former generals, the Union Solidarity and Development Party, defeating many cabinet members. This is the most open election in Myanmar since 1990, when the NLD won a large majority in parliament, but the ruling military junta at the time never recognized the election results and put Suu Kyi, a Nobel Prize winner, under house arrest for most of the past two decades. In the recent election, the generals had hoped to maintain their majority with the aid of ethnic political parties, but those groups voted heavily for Aung San Suu Kyi's party. Despite the opposition's landslide election victory, the military retains plenty of power. The military is allotted 25% of all seats in parliament, and the generals can name powerful ministers, including defence, home affairs, and border control. The army also retains powerful business interests in ruby and jade mines, tobacco and banking. Pushed by social conservatives, several southern states, including Texas, Tennessee and Florida, are now debating the so-called Pastor Protection Act that supporters say would prohibit ministers from being forced to perform same-sex marriages. Yet the legislation is purely symbolic, since the First Amendment to the U.S. Constitution protects clergy from having to perform ceremonies or religious rituals against their will. The push for the bill came as the U.S. Supreme Court legalized same-sex marriage across the U.S. Social conservatives have reacted to new rights for gays and lesbians by calling for laws to protect religious freedom. Despite their allies' current effort, the right-wing Family Research Council recognizes churches and ministers currently have solid protection, and they assert that there's no appreciable risk that clergy would be compelled by a court to host or perform a same-sex wedding. So why are the conservatives pushing for the symbolic Pastor Protection Act, which was signed into law by Texas GOP Governor Greg Abbott in June? Florida pastor Harold Thompson of the Miami Beach Community Church says the true intent of this bill is not to protect pastors, it is not to protect the church, it is to protect an agenda. It is nothing more than a wolf in sheep's clothing, intending to deceive, intending to harm. New York City's progressive mayor Bill de Blasio has launched an ambitious plan to create 80,000 units of new affordable housing and preserve 120,000 units of low-cost apartments. Yet the plan and its reliance on mandatory inclusionary zoning will not be enough, according to many housing advocates who are calling for policies that do more to aid cash-strapped poor New Yorkers. The de Blasio zoning scheme calls for a range of set-asides for affordable units in exchange for granting private developers higher density in new buildings. City Limits magazine reports that the zoning requirement sets aside 20-30% of all units, double the current rate of affordable units built through zoning in other cities. But little of the new housing would be offered to families who make half of New York City's average median income, complains Moses Gates of the Association for Neighborhood and Housing Development. Tom Angotti, a professor of urban affairs at Hunter College, says the city's supply-side approach is flawed since market-rate development in New York City means luxury housing. With low vacancy rates, advocates say the de Blasio administration should focus more on preserving existing affordable housing and building new low-cost units on city-owned land, rather than relying upon private developers. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Nigel Victor Rees.
The shocking terrorist attacks in Paris on November 13th focused world attention on ISIS, the extremist group which claimed responsibility. The well-planned massacre of ordinary Parisians across the city in restaurants, a stadium, and concert hall killed 129 and wounded 352, with 99 remaining in critical condition. In a statement released after the carnage, the terrorist group said it had targeted France for its involvement in the bombing campaign against ISIS forces in both Iraq and Syria. The Paris assault came after other recent attacks claimed by ISIS, including two bombings in Beirut that killed 43, the bombing of a Russian airliner over Egypt that took the lives of 224 passengers, and a double suicide bombing in Ankara, Turkey, targeting a Kurdish political rally that killed 97. The French government responded to the murderous attack by invoking a state of emergency, stepping up its bombing campaign against ISIS in Syria, and launching police raids against suspected ISIS-linked terrorists across France. While President Obama has resisted calls to send large numbers of U.S. troops to battle ISIS in Syria, Republican presidential candidates were quick to criticize the president for not escalating America's military campaign, with some demanding a halt to a White House plan to resettle 10,000 Syrian war refugees in the U.S. They were joined by two dozen Republican governors who said they would suspend the resettlement of Syrian refugees in their states. Your reporter spoke with Vijay Prashad, the George and Martha Kellner Chair in South Asian History and Professor of International Studies at Trinity College. Here, Professor Prashad discusses the goals of the perpetrators of the Paris massacre and policy options to diminish future cycles of violence.
There is indeed an apocalyptic vision. The magazine, very glossy magazine, produced by ISIS is called Dabiq. Dabiq is a town in Syria, a small town, where there is a kind of legendary idea that that is where the final battle will take place. In the apocalypse indeed will happen. You don't forget that Islam, Judaism, they share this view that there is an end times, that there's an apocalyptic moment. And so this should be familiar to people who are raised in these, as it were, Abrahamic religions, where there is this sort of end time philosophy. So yes, there is a section of ISIS that is indeed, believes in an apocalypse. They want to certainly draw in, troops from the West. And they're going to have, engineer this big battle in Dabiq, and there's the end of the world. There are sections like that. There are also people in ISIS who have politics, who are angry with the dispensation. They want to create room for themselves. They are not necessarily motivated by this apocalyptic vision. They've been frustrated with the government in Iraq. They're frustrated with the government in Syria. So there are people like that, and these are the people that are not programmatically committed to the ideology of ISIS. And if they are squeezed, they would walk away from ISIS. These are the low-hanging fruit. Then there are people who live in Europe who are frustrated with the way the domestic policies in Europe, racism, with poverty among, immigrants from Algeria and Morocco. France has the largest, population of North Africans, given miserable conditions. Belgium has, one of the poorest areas of Belgium is entirely North African. So the point I'm making is there are many different motivations for acts of terror. We have to understand them for their multiplicity, and you have to forensically go after different populations based on, you know, what kind of drivers they have. If there are those who are driven by an apocalyptic vision, it's very unlikely to be able to convince them of anything. But the vast bulk of people who join terrorist organizations aren't hardened ideological militants. They have all kinds of opportunistic ideas that draw them to terrorism. And those are the people that need to be politically appealed to. The United States and its allies have been bombing ISIS since August of 2014. And apart from one example, there have been almost no gains. I mean, ISIS works like a pendulum. It doesn't sit in one place. It's 10,000 or so fighters always on the move. And unfortunately, that's exactly what the French have now ramped up and bombing more in Raqqa. Very unlikely it's going to have an effect.
Well, Vijay Prashad, just a final question here. Regional and world powers involved in the Syrian civil war have been working at cross purposes for a number of years now. Do you think these recent terrorist attacks targeting Russia and France and other regional centers of power may offer some hope for these countries to come together to try and address and end the war in Syria and thereby go at the root of the problem when it comes to ISIS and the havoc they've wreaked across the globe?
Scott, this is a very important question. You know, Obama and Putin had a 35-minute meeting where they sat at the margins of the G20 summit, actually in the reception area in Antalya, Turkey. And they spent 35 minutes talking. And what the Russians said after that meeting was that the Obama and Putin agreed broadly on the strategy for Syria. There was disagreement on the tactics. Now, they didn't explain exactly what tactics they were talking about, but this is a slightly positive way forward. You know, I mean, I'm not a believer in great powers solving the problems of ordinary people. You know, I would believe ordinary people solve their own problems. But here, Syria is being suffocated. Half the population has been displaced, you know, the drop by more than 10 years in these 5 years itself. So something needs to be done. And if it's going to take some kind of agreement between these big powers, if they're going to be able to, you know, twist the arms of regional powers and create some drawdown in Syria, anything really, you know, any kind of approach should be welcomed by the world. You know, Syria needs to have some semblance of breathing room. And I think if they can provide it, then we should welcome that.
That was Vijay Prashad, professor of international studies at Trinity College and author of 17 books, including The Darker Nations, A People's History of the Third World. For more analysis and commentary on the world's response to the latest ISIS terrorist attacks, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. The U.S. environmental movement has long had a reputation for attracting mostly white, middle-class activists. But for many decades, the struggle for environmental justice has been fought out in overwhelmingly low-income communities of color that border some of the nation's most polluting industries. In 2009, the NAACP hired Jacqueline Patterson, the first director of the group's Environmental and Climate Justice Program. The program, she explains, was established because at the time, there was no visible racial justice component inside any of the nation's mainstream climate organizations. Over the past 6 years, Patterson has been at the forefront of helping frontline communities integrate climate activism into their agenda and pushing big green environmental groups to integrate a social justice lens into their daily work. Jacqueline Patterson was one of the speakers at the third annual Climate Stewardship Summit on November 5th in West Hartford, Connecticut, sponsored by the Interreligious Eco-Justice Network. In an interview with Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus, Patterson discusses some of the successes a more integrated movement has achieved and the challenges that remain.
When we talk about intersectionality in this climate space, it's about the fact that the same entities that are pushing back on having regulations for clean air, pushing back on incentivizing and supporting research and development and the expansion of clean energy and even energy efficiency, are the same entities that are also pushing for stripping of voting rights and suppressing the vote in certain areas. And the same folks who would vote in favor of the types of regulations that we need, the folks who are most impacted by dirty air and so forth, are the folks whose votes are being suppressed. So we just see a whole intersection between environmental issues and the types of policies that we need and issues around voting rights and voter suppression.
So there was a question raised by a white woman, and I'm saying race because I think it's relevant to the point, that, you know, she looked around the room and most of the people, probably at least 90% of the people here, are white people. I think her point was, well, you know, we have to get everybody involved in this. And the first answer that was given to her by an African-American man was, you know, it's survival issues that a lot of black people are struggling more just to survive. And so they're thinking, you know, the next hour, the next meal, and not necessarily down the road, even though they may understand the issues and they may want to get involved. Do you agree with that analysis?
That is true, certainly, of some people, for sure. And I think he, you know, obviously if there had been more time to have a longer conversation, I think he raised that as one point. I don't think he was saying that explained the whole thing. And so I followed up by saying also that there are folks who are engaging on the front lines of environmental and climate justice struggles because, again, they're the ones who have those things in their backyard. They're the ones who have the high rates of asthma. They're the ones who have people dying of lung disease even though they've never smoked a day in their lives. I mean, they're the ones who are facing all of this. And so the communities I work with, there's communities all over the country that are engaged in this all day, every day. One of the questions is why it is that this group isn't connected to those groups. So I think that's kind of the bigger question we need to ask in terms of, you know, what kind of relationships we need to be building at the local level so that, you know, if there's a group, you know, doing this work all day, every day, and then there's another group having a similar conversation someplace else, why it is that they're not connecting together. And so those are some of the questions I'd love to see asked. And then also, there are communities. When we first did our report called Cold-Blooded Putting Profits Before People, where we were looking at coal-fired power plants throughout the country, there were definitely communities where the coal plants might be right in their backyard, but they would say to us, you know, we drive past that thing every day and we never tied it to the fact that half the people in our church are on respirators and half the kids in our schools are carrying asthma inhalers every day. We just never made that connection because this is just the way our lives are. Like, this is just the state of affairs. We didn't know necessarily that it's different from any other community. And so we really started to have some conversations around these connections. And as I said in answer to that same question before as well, that people haven't done a good job, the big environmental groups, in messaging these real human impacts. They've been talking about the polar bears, the ice caps, the bees, you know, all these different things that people don't necessarily tie to their everyday lives. And so we really have started with a whole story collection piece. And that's what we really focused on, is collecting stories around climate change and how it's affecting communities so that people do see it through a story-based lens.
Do you feel like either the Sierra Club or any other, I mean, they're the biggest grassroots based of the Big Greens, but do you feel like the Sierra Club or any other quote unquote Big Green group has been making progress toward incorporating issues of climate justice into their work?
That's the one thing that I've seen in the evolution over the 6 years, that there has been definitely more of a leaning in and more of a conversation around how these different issues intersect. Sierra Club in particular, they have a great environmental justice program, and they have made a commitment to diversity and inclusion and doing training around that throughout the organization. So that's been positive. They explicitly leaned into the Black Lives Matter movement, and that's been positive as well. And there are conversations about not leaning into other issues in a quid pro quo way, like we're going to do this and then we want you to do that, but really recognizing that these issues are directly intersectional. The fact that Black lives are devalued in association with interactions with the police is related to the fact that Black lives are devalued in that the black communities are disproportionately dumped on or contaminated and polluted. So it's really all the same conversation. It's not trading engagement. Also, Sierra Club, Greenpeace, Earth Justice, and Union of Concerned Scientists and others, some of these big greens, have leaned into this process called the Building Equity and Alignment Initiative, which is a collaboration between grassroots frontline community groups, big green organizations, and foundations, where they're all coming together to really talk explicitly about how we can change the way we're doing this and how we can center anti-oppression work and, you know, real frontline community leadership in advancing this movement.
That was Jacqueline Patterson, director of the NAACP's Environmental and Climate Justice Program. For more information on the group's climate and justice work, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. On November 10th, the Criminal Justice Division of the Oregon Department of Justice revealed that it had secretly spied on state residents who used the Black Lives Matter hashtag in their Twitter accounts. Among those surveilled was the state's own Director of Civil Rights, Arias Johnson. In response to a letter signed by a number of Oregon groups, including the Urban League of Portland, the state AFL-CIO, the ACLU of Oregon, and several chapters of the NAACP, Oregon's Attorney General Ellen Rosenblum stated that she was shocked and appalled by the surveillance conducted by a Department of Justice investigator employed in the state's Criminal Justice Division. The groups collectively expressed their outrage for what they said was the improper and potentially unlawful surveillance and investigation of an Oregonian merely for expressing a viewpoint or for being part of a social movement. The ACLU of Oregon went further by characterizing state spying on legally protected political speech on Twitter as racial profiling, offensive, and a serious threat to our democracy. Together, these progressive groups submitted a list of demands to the Attorney General that included a call for an immediate halt to the surveillance, a thorough independent public investigation, and an apology. The local chapter of the ACLU has filed records requests to state agencies, the U.S. Department of Justice and FBI, seeking information on the extent of the surveillance, the technology used, and those who were profiled. Your reporter spoke with Matt Dos Santos, legal director with the ACLU of Oregon, who talks about the many unanswered questions surrounding the surveillance, its motivation, and the need for a full and transparent investigation into these activities.
We were approached by both the Attorney General's office and the Urban League of Portland, who conveyed the situation to us. And, you know, while we've been told by the Attorney General that the surveillance was stopped as soon as she found out about it, we still don't really know how long the surveillance was actually happening.
So was any rationale offered for their engaging in the surveillance?
Well, look, it's unclear right now, and certainly the stuff that we've heard isn't particularly palatable. The AG has suggested that it may have been a rogue employee playing with a demo of software, but that doesn't make a lot of sense to me. It also contradicts her previous statements that the Criminal Justice Division was looking for information about anti-police sentiment or violence in conducting the surveillance.
I did want to ask you about a particular individual who was apparently targeted or identified in the surveillance, and that's an individual named Arias Johnson, who I believe is the state's Director of Civil Rights. In what context were they surveilling this state official?
So that's a really great question for the Criminal Justice Division of the Department of Justice, and one that we honestly hope we can get answered soon. What we've heard so far is that the Criminal Justice Division was looking for anti-police sentiment or violence. But like I said, that's a tough pill to swallow, given that they actually looked into, in some depth, their own Director of Civil Rights. I mean, we think that this constitutes racial profiling. And at least the upside of some of the comments that the Attorney General has made, in addition to just generally saying that she's outraged by what is happening, is she appears to also believe that this is racial profiling. We have a task force, actually, that was put together on racial profiling, on which the Attorney General and the ACLU of Oregon are both participants. And so we hope to hear a little bit more about that. You know, I think it's important to remember that the Black Lives Matter movement is Black-led. And, you know, it's important to remember that the Black Lives Matter movement is a peaceful political movement with really important concerns and questions about police violence in communities of color and this very thing we're talking about, racial profiling.
Matt, tell us about the coalition of groups that have risen to the challenge here of these revelations of surveillance of the Black Lives Matter movement. Who's involved in pressing the government of Oregon to investigate and reveal really what's been going on here?
So the Urban League of Portland was the author of the letter. It came from Nikenge Harmon Johnson, who is actually married to the Civil Rights Division director, Arias Johnson. And so they've certainly been involved in this event and the revelations leading up to where we are today. Other organizations that are involved are the Center for Intercultural Organizing, the NAACP, APANO, which is one of our stalwart groups that look out for the Asian Pacific Islander community here in Portland. And so that whole community of folks were concerned because they know for a fact that their members are using this hashtag Black Lives Matter every day. And certainly that was one of the reasons why the ACLU of Oregon was so concerned, because we think our members have a right to talk about this really important issue without the threat of government surveillance.
And what specifically is this coalition of groups asking the government of Oregon to do here in response to these revelations?
So the letter that was initially sent to the Attorney General called for a few things. One of them was an immediate halt to digital and other surveillance of Black Lives Matter-related topics and individuals who might be using that particular hashtag. We called for an independent audit to determine who at the Oregon Department of Justice created and authorized this, quote, threat assessment practice, when it began, whether the investigations included email, browser history, phone, and other online or offline activity, and what were the department's intentions in creating that program, and what, frankly, has been done with that information, whether it was shared with other local, state, county, or federal organizations. And we also asked for whether the Criminal Justice Division was properly supervised or trained to avoid racial bias. I think that's going to be really important for us to understand. And finally, an apology and disclosure to all Oregonians who were ensnared in this dragnet.
That was Matt Dos Santos, legal director with the ACLU of Oregon. Find more information on the Oregon Department of Justice surveillance of state residents by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Richard Hill, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Nigel Reese, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap.
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Mumia Abu-Jamal's radio essay.
To serve and protect, or ravish and wreck, whoever we are, no matter our media source, we need not go far to find a praise story in the press about police. A cop pulls a man from a burning car. A cop helps an old lady across the street. These are staples upon which the media machine feeds. Yet, when the Associated Press Media Wire Service released its recent exclusive on police across the country engaging in hundreds of acts of sexual oppression, rape, sodomy, and targeted sexual molestation of children, the silence has been deafening. Almost 1,000 cops, from sheriff deputies to so-called school resource officers, raping, sodomizing, forcing women, children, and men into sexually compromised positions is, to say the least, deeply shocking. The article, which filled a whole page of the Sunday Times of Scranton, Pennsylvania, featured a chilling account of a woman in her 50s returning home from a game of dominoes with friends. Suddenly, a police car signaled her to stop, and she did so. For the cop's safety, she was pat-searched. Then her blouse was pulled up, and her pants were pulled down. Another search. Clearly unarmed, the woman was forced to give the cop oral sex in the patrol car of the Oklahoma City Police Department. The cop barked out, "Come on, I don't have all night." The AP researched hundreds of cases such as these from all over the country, covering some 44 states. Journalist Matt Sedensky and Noman Marchant found cases covering children in school suffering molestation from so-called school resource officers, to teenaged members of police internship programs chased, harassed, and raped by their adult police trainers. As shocking as it is repellent, this is a story of police gone wild, where they serve and protect themselves and treat those who pay them as so much rubbish. If you haven't read this in your local paper, or heard it on radio, or seen it covered in the news of your local or national news programs, you have been woefully misinformed about the true nature of American police. This ain't law and order. These are the actions of outlaws and disorder masquerading as peace officers. This is America's rape culture, silent, hidden violence against the weak, the unarmed, the young, and the helpless. This is America at the beginning of a new century in the grip of police madness. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio. political masters, financial servants. Some call it the silly season. But if the national presidential elections are a measure, then we can't speak of seasons, but of years, for the time spent on this endeavor is extensive. And it's a multi-million dollar business. Indeed, billions are spent. While most of this money goes to the media industry, some candidates amass great fortunes to wield as cudgels to discourage adversaries, as in, look at all the money I've got. Media, driven by their own profit motives, grants immediate credibility to a candidate who has a boatload of money. So money is the measure of a candidate, not one's ideas. Now, after the odious decision in Citizens United, a candidate can run a campaign based on the support of one person, that is, one rich person. Who needs democracy when you have a rich sugar daddy? Also, the debates we've been seeing are unworthy of the name. Debates are arguments or discussions involving public policy. The so-called debates we see are hurried sound bites meant to titillate audiences and snatch some face time with media. It argues nothing and explains less. It is political entertainment and used by media to hype coverage to boost ratings. It is a circle of emptiness. Journalist scholar Chris Hedges would describe these so-called debates as the elevation of spectacle above any real relationship to real life or the problems faced daily by real people. No matter who gets elected, ask yourself one question. Is this person responsive to the average citizen or to those on Wall Street? We know the answer. The intimate embrace by the political class of the moneyed class has served to bypass the illusions of democracy. One serves the other. One buys the other. One owns the other. And the people are becoming increasingly irrelevant. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio. Governors representing nearly half the United States, 23 states in all, bum-rushed the mic to announce that they're issuing orders to ban refugees from Syria into their states. Is it mere coincidence that 22 of them are Republican governors? I think not. For what political party best exploits fear for its own political gain? How many millions of people still believe that U.S. President Barack Obama is a secret Muslim? Political fear is so deep that it doesn't matter how many Muslims he bombs by drone, nor how many Bibles he carries. He's a secret Muslim. Incredible. To be sure, this is not a new phenomenon. Back in the 1920s, millions came to the U.S., but Congress set strict limits for Africans, Asians, Slavs, Jews, and Italians. The favored immigrant was from England or Northern Europe. Those perceived as darker people were severely limited. It was the politics of fear then. It's the politics of fear now. Those who are most at risk from a mad insurgency birthed by U.S., British, Pakistani, and Saudi intelligence, those forces that armed, trained, formed, and indoctrinated anti-Soviet groups like Al-Qaeda, are being banned and barred from immigration to the U.S. Amazing. The politics of fear brew the pots of paranoia in people. It closes minds. And as Iraq proved, it opened the door to more and more disaster. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
Are there any glaring omissions or distortions in the way the November 13th Paris attacks are being presented in the mainstream media? How effective have counter-narratives in the independent media been, and how could the powers that be respond to that kind of messaging? How authentic is the French president's claim that his country's recent airstrikes in Syria are a direct result of the attacks? What are the consequences for civil liberties in the French Republic and for refugee flows out of Syria? On this week's Global Research News Hour, we take a look at the Paris bombings with two guests. Media critic Barry Zwicker evaluates mainstream and independent media coverage of the attacks, while Professor Michel Chossudovsky of the Center for Research on Globalization dissects the actions of the French government and its allies, given documented research into the Islamic extremist militants, such as ISIL. On this week's show, Parisian deception, manipulating the public into war. Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of November 20th, 2015. I'm series host and producer Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg. We seek to provide you with access to analysis of the major issues shaping our world today from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our program is available from the Center's website, globalresearch.ca. We also can now be heard on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We'll begin our show with news notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. For the last 12 hours, we've been constantly refreshing Google News for just one Western article about Putin's bombshell comments at the G20 summit in Antalya. You would think that the Russian president stating publicly that ISIS is receiving money from 40 different countries, including G20 members, would be newsworthy, right? Typically, at least the Daily Beast has the common courtesy to distort or misrepresent the most recent Putin press conference. But in this instance, there is literally no written Western record of Putin saying anything about who finances ISIS during the G20 summit in Turkey. That comes from the article, Putin outed ISIS's G20 financiers, but not a single Western media outlet has reported it, by Rudy Panko, posted November 19th, originally appearing at Russia Insider. The Kurds have seized and now maintain control of an area that spans the Turkey-Syria border from its western to eastern extremities, all except for one small pocket in the middle, from Jarablus in the east to Dabik in the west. Others have described the zone in slightly different dimensions as being from Jarablus in the east to Afrin in the east. With the growing awareness of the importance of the Jarablus corridor amongst researchers, observers, and the interested national parties, the recent Turkish-U.S. joint military operation agreement stands as a last-ditch effort to solidify the ISIS-NATO presence in Syria. By engaging troops and military hardware over the quote-unquote safe zone of the Jarablus corridor, NATO will be able to ensure that ISIS supplies and soldiers continue to pour into Syria unabated. By placing NATO interests in the midst of the corridor and declaring the zone a quote-unquote safe zone, the hope is that the Russians will see the zone as off-limits. That comes from the article, U.S.-Turkey Joint Operation Designed to Save ISIS, Not Destroy It, by Brandon Turbeville, posted November 18th, originally appearing in Activist Post. The Saudis and Emiratis may have just recently incorporated Eritrea into their coalition framework, but Qatar has been cultivating close ties with Asmara for the past 5 years as part of its mediation role in resolving the Djibouti border dispute, which incidentally saw it deploy 200 troops to the country. This means that the Muslim Brotherhood espousing state is in a position to project its ideology throughout the region and intensify cooperation with its al-Shabaab proxy in nearby Somalia. In such circumstances, the GCC wouldn't be able to indefinitely hold out the threat of Islamic-inspired terrorist destabilization as a means of blackmailing the world's fastest-growing economy and one of Africa's up-and-coming powers, but would have to reluctantly join in the Qatari-initiated unrest so as to secure whatever benefits they can while there's still the opportunity to do so. The ethnic, social, and religious cleavages already prevalent, and even overlapping in some cases, in Ethiopia provide more than enough domestic gunpowder for a strategically placed spark to set the whole powder keg aflame, with the only fail-safe solution being for Addis Ababa to overwhelmingly respond with military force. Such a reaction might predictably scare away the investors that are needed to keep the Ethiopian miracle alive, and the combination of capital outflow plus military suppression, no matter how justified it may seem, might further exacerbate the domestic differences in the country and place them in a perpetual process of worsening up to the point of the country approaching the geopolitical abyss of disillusion along pre-existing ethnic federative lines. That comes from the article, Saudi Arabia and the GCC are expanding to Eritrea, geopolitical implications for Ethiopia, by Andrew Korybko, posted November 18th, originally appearing at Katahan. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. On Friday, November 13th, six separate attacks with guns and suicide bombs left 129 people dead. The blame was quickly shifted to the Islamic State and used as a pretext for France's massive military strikes in Syria over the weekend, as well as the closing of borders and the severe restrictions of civil liberties in the country. Essentially, the French government has declared martial law. Media is an important agent in assessing the justification for these measures, so the Global Research News Hour got in touch with a prominent Canadian media critic to get his thoughts about the way the attacks and their fallout are being covered. Barry Zwicker is a veteran journalist, commentator, and media critic. He is the author of the 2006 book Towers of Deception, The Media Cover-Up of 9/11, and is working on another book focusing on a history of false flag operations. Good morning, Barry Zwicker.
Good morning, Michael.
Okay, so last week we saw these devastating attacks in Paris, 129 people killed, and six separate attacks, and of course just this week we had this big raid. And I know that you've argued that the attacks of 9/11 and the Ottawa shootings a year ago were orchestrated by the state and not by rogue Islamic extremists acting on their own. I'm assuming that you strongly suspect that the attacks in Paris were likewise fit the profile of a classic false flag. And I was wondering what aspects of last week's events would lead you to that suspicion.
Well, you are correct in your assumption, and I think it's well-founded. It's based on, in part, actually, the sort of two-part focus that in an email you and I agreed we could approach this conversation on. And that would be the two areas that relate to the events in Paris. One is coverage of those events by the mainstream media, or the MSM. And the MSM being print, that's newspapers and magazines, plus radio, plus TV, and now MSM on the Internet. So that's one area. A second area is alternative or counter mainstream media coverage of these events in France. Now, that would be on the Internet alone. And there's a third area arising from the first two, and that's what you've asked me about, the most important area, really, and that's each person's takeaway on the events, whichever his or her sources of information are. And I don't know, maybe we'll have time to edge into that. But if I may, I'd like to address this question of the mainstream coverage.
Yes.
First. Now, I must say, I hope this is not too much inside baseball, that analysis of media coverage is quite time-consuming if it's done properly. For 3.5 years, I did a weekly commentary for CBC National Radio called Facing the Fourth Estate. This was pre-internet. And each of my commentaries ran 3 minutes, give or take. Typically, I found myself devoting a good part of 2 or even into 3 days researching, writing, and rewriting those 3-minute scripts. Now, fast forward to today, I'm working on a book about false flag ops, as you mentioned in the intro. And for me, the events in Paris are a professional concern, if you will. I'm touched as a citizen and everything, and as a human being. But they're a professional concern because media coverage of all kinds remains central for me in this book I'm writing. And the mainstream media coverage especially, because the MSM are such a huge problem of malignant manipulation of the public mind. Now, this means I'm experiencing a huge change in my job description, self-appointed media critic, of researching and writing. And with the Paris events, this is the first time in my life this has been so clearly the case to me. The number of hours I have to devote to reading and viewing and listening to mainstream media coverage, those number of hours are being rivaled by the number of hours of reading and viewing and listening I must devote to alternative viewpoints on the internet. And, most of the counter coverage includes, not surprisingly, harsh criticism of the MSM coverage. So the question arises, in connection with the Paris events, how do the MSM mislead? And this applies also to, it applied, of course, to 9/11, and it applies to every damn false flag operation that comes down the pike. So there are 3 ways the MSM mislead, roughly speaking, 3 ways. First is by them being stenographers and megaphones for official propaganda. For instance, presenting unfiltered and unquestioned assertions by presidents and generals and the talking heads of spy agencies that specialize in deception and from so-called counterterrorism experts who work for bodies that usually actually make a profit from terrorism or alleged terrorism. So that's one way, is being amplifiers of official stories. The second way the MSM mislead is by their omissions. An example would be that they raise the roof about 100 and some dead from the alleged Islamic terrorism shootings in Paris. And I mean no disrespect whatsoever for the dead or the grieving in Paris. But these MSM, at the same time, failed to mention the hundreds of thousands of dead from unmistakably Western bombs and shootings in Iraq and Libya and now Syria, or missile strikes from clearly Western drones above Pakistan, and all of which would unquestionably be experienced as terror attacks by the victims and their families in those countries. So these omissions by the MSM constitute systemic hypocrisy.
I would also point out, sorry to interrupt, but there is also the America's, I think it's important to emphasize America's bombing of the, in Afghanistan, of the Médecins Sans Frontières facility and the people who died there, and we don't seem to that attack didn't seem to get a lot of coverage. I mean, it got some, but it wasn't didn't get the kind of emphasis that we're seeing with Paris.
Well, probably not, but I was half satisfied by the coverage. I mean, so often these things just don't make it into the papers at all. I mean, there's been all sorts of war crimes committed in Afghanistan and Iraq and Libya and Syria, and they involve sometimes thousands of people. I mean, you have, for instance, the quote accidental, and they could be accidental in one sense, you know, bombings of wedding parties in Afghanistan. You know, blowing up people at a wedding or a funeral. And another one that just occurs to me is in Iraq. I don't know if you remember, and I can't really tell you whether it... I think it was the first, you know, Iraq incursion, the one that George Bush Sr. didn't finish. The so-called Allied bombers just wiped out a whole convoy of vehicles and everybody in them. It was about 10 miles long, and they just came and strafed and bombed that whole line, this whole highway full of vehicles. People were burned alive. And I remember it, but it didn't get much coverage, you know. It didn't get the coverage it should have. I think that's your point, right? Mm.
Yeah. Well, what other glaring omissions have you located with regard to the Paris attacks?
Well, the omissions, you know, I'd like to go on to the third form of misleading. I will go on to the third way that the MSM mislead us. But the omissions and that one is really major, of omitting to mention the much larger terrorist activities of the West when an alleged even terrorist event has happened in the West. I mean, that is your overarching, hypocritical, misleading, mind-boggling omission. But smaller omissions happen. Now, for instance, with Charlie Hebdo, there was a police inspector in Paris who was investigating the circumstances of the Charlie Hebdo massacre. And guess what? You know the answer to what happened to him, eh?
What's that?
He was alleged to have committed suicide, right? Like 2 or 3 days after the massacre, and he's in charge of an investigation. And then they said that he committed suicide. The media omitted to follow up this alleged suicide. Just one small example, Michael, of, you know, the omissions abound. But those are just ones that pop into my mind. But if I may...
It's a common theme, is that, you know, with you know, people just suspiciously dying or getting killed, and you have no witnesses that you can interrogate later.
Well, yeah, I'm not sure whether those fall in the category of omissions as I mean them.
Well, it's questions that journalists should be exploring.
Well, yeah, there are questions that should be explored and aren't. And there are facts that are completely covered up, and then there are ones that are downplayed. So you have total omission, and then you have marginalization or trivialization of events that are known, but they're not being reported with the weight and the size and the placement that they deserve. And that, you know, that all falls under the general umbrella of hypocrisy. Mm. Anyway, there's this third, the two forms being propagandizing for the state, and the second one omission, and the third one is misleading interpretations. Now you find these misleading interpretations. By, you know, what we call the commentariat in the mainstream, and conclusions put forth in editorials. And these interpretations, in turn, you see, are based on the first two of the three legs of manipulation of the public mind, the state propaganda plus the omissions. Then you get the interpretations. Well, it just lays them on, and it just becomes like almost a seamless blanket of lying and hypocrisy. So it's not unfair to characterize the blending of these three as simply serial lies and extreme hypocrisy from and by the mainstream media. Mm-hmm. And that, in turn, tends to hide the malignant complicity of those mainstream media with the terrorism the West inflicts around the world. You know, I mean, it's really a wonder to behold how this all works out. But paradoxically, once a person escapes this admittedly very large bubble of the mainstream propaganda and omission and interpretation, the lies kind of jump out and reveal themselves. Although those still in the bubble still see the lies as truths.
So as we escape the bubble, what are your thoughts about independent media coverage?
Well, that is where it's really rather wonderful that there is so much more counter-information, pushback of facts and interpretation and framing on the internet now for those who decide to access it, and that is really big. Like there are honorable exceptions, of course, within this bubble. You know, you can find sheer facts even in the Paris coverage. I mean, there are things that are incontrovertible. Now, you know, who is behind them is another thing, but it'd be incontrovertible about the number of dead and so on. So, you know, those are facts that you can work with. But the larger truth about the massive hypocritical lying on the really big issues, that truth is hard to access without what Marshall McLuhan called an anti-environment. And he said, we don't know who discovered water, but we know it wasn't a fish. So maybe we're not in a bubble, we're in a fish tank. But and I'll tell you, Michael, I am over the moon that the other day, our 11-year-old granddaughter, I was driving her to her tutorial. We were having a great talk, and I was asking her about her schoolwork. And lo and behold, she quoted that saying by McLuhan, that we don't know who discovered water, but we know it wasn't a fish. And the reason she could quote it to me is because she has a daily media literacy class. So I really thought that is wonderful. Mm. And I think she's already growing up to be a progressive skeptic. And her parents certainly are.
Yeah. I know that you mentioned, I know we've only got a couple of minutes left in this, but you mentioned in your book, The Towers of Deception, that there are so-called gatekeepers, you know, outlets that present as non-corporate and progressive, but they still toe the state line. And you named Noam Chomsky as an example of this phenomenon. Have you been able to locate any examples of that kind of activity with regard to Paris 11-13?
I haven't. Like, I'm in the middle of my research, or even I'm behind with it. I mean, I've got a stack of papers here that I haven't even finished reading that I want to analyze for the wording and the placement and all that. I can't right off the top of my head say that I've identified left gatekeepers in the current situation, but they would be, in regard to Paris, probably the likes of reader-supported news. Now, reader-supported news, which a lot of people like, and I, you know, follow it because I'm signed up for it every day, reader-supported news never, ever, ever touches 9/11 truth. And I've been an activist. I haven't just been, you know, sitting and moaning the blues here at my computer. Three separate times I have communicated with Mark Ash, the founder and the guy who runs reader-supported news. And in fact, one was an email, and twice I sent him surface mail letters, which were brief and civil. And I've said in each one, in respect to your request for donations, I said, I will give what I can afford to reader-supported news, even on a monthly basis, if reader-supported news will touch the matter of 9/11 truth. I have not even received an acknowledgement of those three.
Mm.
So, there's one of your left gatekeeping portals on the internet, and there are many others. I mean, you can tell them because, A, they won't touch 9/11, or B, they will touch 9/11, which means they're a deeper hidden gatekeeper.
Right.
But, you know, if there's just a half a minute left.
Yeah, maybe a minute or so.
Yeah, something that struck me in the course of preparing, you know, for this conversation. And it's what it is. It's a thought or a worry or a threat or something I've had in mind for years now about the internet. And it could even turn into a prediction. And it's this. The minute that for the global elites, the internet's value to them as a surveillance tool appears to them to be the internet's threat to their rule, that is the minute they will one way or another deny internet access to everybody who would appear collectively to be on the cusp of mounting an effective program of resistance to the global agenda. And they can do it. I mean, I have no doubt that the global super elite possesses the technical means of doing this and dealing with the pushback. And as a matter of fact, this increasingly full-fledged fear campaign about terrorists and terrorism and terror threats, terror plots and everything, softens up the mass public psyche to be open to such a crackdown. And, you know, right in Harper's proposed bill, C-44, was it, or one of the other bills, he would have had it that, quote, supporters of the promotion of terrorism, unquote, you know, would be open to be spied on and even shut down and everything. Or if you're a threat to national security, these vague things. So in other words, all those of us who are progressive skeptics and civil rights and peace and justice and environmental activists, you know, make no mistake, we can be singled out and denied service one way or another, or be so disrupted that our effectiveness is sapped. And people may or may not know about what's called the dark internet or the deep web or internet 2. I think they can flip a toggle switch if this other internet is ready with all of us targeted. They can just flip a toggle switch in effect and bang, internet as we know it is gone for a lot of us. But it'd probably be done surreptitiously and in a very sneaky way because there could be a public outcry. But I think they have the technical ability to do it, and they would be waiting for the time to do it and figuring out exactly how to do it. That's my worry.
A very important alert. I thank you for that, Barry Zwicker. I've got to leave now, but thank you again for your analysis of this situation. Very timely, very important.
It is that, and a lot of us have to keep working at it and try to reveal the hidden aspects.
Barry Zwicker is a veteran journalist, commentator, and media critic, author of the 2006 book Towers of Deception, The Media Cover-Up of 9/11. He's working on a new book on false flag operations. He's based in Toronto.
You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcast out of Winnipeg on campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM and on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We are also podcast on the website globalresearch.ca.
For his thoughts about the Paris bombings, we're joined by Professor Michel Chossadovsky. Professor Chossadovsky is an award-winning author, professor of economics at the University of Ottawa, founder and director of the Center for Research on Globalization in Montreal and editor of Global Research. He's the author of 11 books, including America's War on Terrorism from 2005, Towards a World War III Scenario, The Dangers of Nuclear War in 2011, and most recently, The Globalization of War, America's Long War Against Humanity. He joins us from Montreal. Thanks for joining us, Professor Chostadovsky.
I'm delighted to be on the program.
Is there anything in particular about what has come out about the bombings from the last week that leads you to believe or suspect that these attacks were fabricated, or at the very least, that there was foreknowledge?
Well, I'd rather focus on the issue of the alleged architects of these attacks, because the official story is that this was an act of war from outside France, instigated by the self-proclaimed Islamic State, which has its headquarters in northern Syria in the city of Raqqa. Now, that's the official story. And the French president has emphasized the broader geopolitical and security implications of his assertions. Officially, and that's what the media has picked up, the attacks were depended on the command structures in Syria. They were executed on behalf of the Islamic State, and that this in turn means that France can invoke Article 5, or could invoke Article 5 of the Washington Treaty, which is the founding document of the of NATO, on the grounds of self-defense, and that its allies must come to its rescue, and so on. Now, this kind of logic of saying we've been attacked by the Islamic State, and consequently we are entitled to retribution directed against the Islamic State, involves President Hollande in a very contradictory discourse, because it just so happens that the Islamic State is supported by France's allies and by France itself. The Islamic State is active throughout Syria, but specifically in northern Syria. It has been the object of war waged by government forces in Syria against the terrorists, and these terrorists are known to be supported by the Western Military Alliance. When Obama declared his campaign against the ISIS last August, September, this campaign was in effect, theoretically at least, directed against the same enemies of the Syrian government, namely the so-called jihadist terrorists, Al-Qaeda-affiliated terrorists. And the war campaign, or the bombing campaign initiated by the United States and its allies, was labeled as an anti- or counterterrorism undertaking, when in fact it was a de facto no-fly zone involving bombing campaigns against civilian infrastructure throughout Syria, on the pretext that they were involved in some kind of humanitarian undertaking. Now, two important occurrences with regard to the Paris bombings. Immediately following the bombing raid, France's president orders that France strike back, so to speak, the empire strikes back, against the Islamic State headquarters in Raqqa in northern Syria. And essentially, the French Air Force, out of its military facilities in the United Arab Emirates, sends in its warplanes and starts bombing Raqqa, and then the Ministry of Defense actually indicates that these bombings have targeted the control posts of the Islamic State. But the evidence that we've received subsequent to the French Ministry of Defense's press release is that these airstrikes essentially were intended to destroy Syria's social infrastructure. They targeted a museum, health clinics, and the stadium. And reports suggest that the terrorists were in fact evacuated. Now, that pattern is nothing new. From the very outset of the bombing campaign in last August, September, coalition bombings, including those of France, have targeted Syria rather than the Islamic State. And they're using the Islamic State as a pretext. But the problem now the French government has, but in fact the entire coalition, is that they are officially involved in a war on terrorism, but at the same time, they are supporting the terrorists. And recent reports have confirmed Turkey's involvement in supporting the terrorists, Saudi Arabia's involvement in supporting the terrorists, and so on, and France's involvement in supporting the terrorists, which started in effect in Libya in 2011 when they supported the Libya Islamic Fighting Group, which is an al-Qaeda-affiliated organization, and that support was directed against the government of Muammar Gaddafi, and it just so happens that the same units of the Libya Islamic Fighting Group now have integrated the Islamic State brigades in northern Syria. So that without necessarily getting into a debate on false flags, I don't think we need to get into a debate on false flags. What we have to underscore and what the French public should realize and what Canadians should realize is that there's a bloody lie there. The French president says we've been attacked by the Islamic State Caliphate. This is an act of war. We closed down our borders. We're being attacked. But who is behind the Islamic State? The French government is behind the Islamic State together with its partners. So you're involved in a non sequitur. And what the media should be reporting on, which is amply documented, it should be connecting the dots, obviously, it should be saying, how is it that the French government is sticking to this discourse that we're being attacked by the Islamic State while at the same time supporting the Islamic State?
Well, that's the rub, isn't it? Because as with your previous writing on 9/11, I mean, the heart of your research was directed to, well, who is al-Qaeda? And similarly, you said, well, the U.S. has been supporting and created al-Qaeda as an intelligence asset. And this is essentially the same idea. But the official story is that, well, no, they're an outside enemy, and this is and it seems like it's very difficult to the rub is that you have to have that admission that the U.S. and its Western allies are supporters of IS. And what we're seeing in this case is that, well, no, we're supporting the moderate terrorists. The moderate rebels in Syria. So I don't know your response to that.
Yes, but the thing is there are various narratives which are contradicting one another. I don't believe that there's any such thing as moderate terrorists. It's a non sequitur. But even if we accept that there are moderate elements within the anti-government forces, which are in fact all mercenaries. I mean, they're hired mercenaries. we know, and it's documented, even the U.S. State Department will say, yes, well, okay, Saudi Arabia and Qatar are supporting the bad guys. What can we do about it? But what is never mentioned is that the United States is supporting Saudi Arabia. They're arming Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia is a proxy state. So is Qatar. They're not acting on their own volition. They're not arming the rebels and training them and recruiting them and sending, in fact, they're even sending people on death row. Said, yes, we, you know, the prisons of Saudi Arabia have sent inmates to the war theater. And so we're in a situation where France has said we have been attacked by an outside power, that in fact that was exactly the same narrative as what happened on the morning of September 12th when the Atlantic Council met in Brussels and invoked Article 5 of the Washington Treaty, saying that the United States had been attacked by a foreign power, intimating that Afghanistan was attacking America, and consequently we had to strike back under the doctrine of collective security. Now, they're doing exactly the same here. But now they're mixing things together. They're actually what they want is an Article 5 agreement or a similar agreement under clauses of the European Union, which will enable them to escalate the war on Syria. And in effect, they want to wage war on Syria in a sense by equating Syria with this outside force, which are the terrorists. It's a very convoluted argument, and it becomes even more complex because the Russians now say, we are going after the terrorists and we will collaborate with you. And they actually, President Vladimir Putin actually is now establishing a dialogue with François Hollande. Now, why are the Russians doing that? Well, because they're pretty slick diplomats. They know perfectly well that NATO is threatening them. They know that France is firmly allied with the United States. They are committed to waging war in Syria and Iraq. But at the same time, they have to play by their narrative. If they say we're against the war on terrorism, and the Russians say, well, we're also waging the war on terrorism against ISIS, well, let's join hands. And that's a way for Russia to create certain divisions within the Western military alliance. And I think that politicians are not always aware of who is manipulating them from behind.
Speaking of politicians, what do you make of the timing of this attacks happening just before the big G20 meeting?
Well, I don't, we can speculate on these timings, and we'd have to start having some more information. But with regard to timing, I think some of the events which preceded the Paris attacks are worth mentioning. The fact that that 1 week before the attacks, the French government ordered the deployment of Charles de Gaulle, the Charles de Gaulle aircraft carrier, and its supporting group. It's a formidable force, to the Eastern Mediterranean. That was announced on November the 5th, 1 week before. 2 weeks before, John Brennan, head of the CIA, meets his French counterpart in Paris, and they had discussions at Langley, but they also appeared at a conference at George Washington University. And in fact, the director of French intelligence actually pointed to the fact that France was threatened by an outside force, and he was talking about the Islamic State with its headquarters in Syria. So those consultations took place 2 weeks before. A month and a half before the events, the French magazine Paris Match featured an interview in which actually detailed the fact that a forthcoming terror event was in the planning stage, was likely, was unavoidable. There were other media actually who reflected upon this, I think going back to August. So there were a whole series of events which preceded the main event in Paris. Are they related or not? At this stage, we can simply point them out and without making any further discussion on them, because we don't have sufficient information. But I think they are certainly significant in viewing this process.
In the case of 9/11, which was the other big devastating attack, that triggered the war on Afghanistan and then Iraq, and also the Patriot Act, and other countries brought in severe anti-terrorism legislation. What do you see this latest event triggering as moving to the geopolitical stage? What's going to be the consequences of this attack?
Well, certainly as far as France is concerned, from my standpoint, this is the end of the French Republic. Because when a government declares a state of emergency in response to a terror event prior to the conduct of a police investigation without knowing what are the underlying causes, etc., etc., and then closes the borders and then gives green light to police and security personnel to conduct house arrests, perquisitions and house searches and arrests without a warrant throughout France, throughout France. This is the transition towards a police state. And it's coupled also with legislation which seeks to go after the so-called conspiracy theorists, the alternative media within France, people who might disagree with this media consensus. And I've been following the French news right from the outset, and the discourse is incredible. I mean, they're saying, oh, France is at war. We've been attacked by a foreign power. What should we do? We should liquidate these people, go after them. And then there's a big campaign throughout France, which is largely directed against the Muslim population. We're talking about 10% of the population of France, okay? Something of that order. And so there have been reports as to the number of arrests, the number of house searches, and they're significant, but I would suspect that many of those house searches and arrests and acts of intimidation are simply not reported upon. And it's something which is happening throughout the country and which is terrorizing a significant sector of the French population. And then when you say a War Measures Act, okay, it's a War Measures Act, similar to the one that we in Canada declared in 1970. That state of emergency is symbolic because it really indicates a transition coupled with the other pieces of legislation which I mentioned towards a de facto police state or totalitarian regime under the facade of French democracy or the French Republic. The French Republic is dead. And that's something we must understand. And France, as opposed to some of its other European partners, has become a staunch American proxy. We don't have the same discourse in Germany or even in Britain or even Italy or Spain. It's the French government, but also the French media and French intellectuals have joined this consensus to say, yes, we are in a state of war. We must defend ourselves. And how do they defend themselves? They send in their powerful naval forces and air force to the Mediterranean to bomb Syria, or to continue bombing Syria on the grounds that they're going after the terrorists. And this is, of course, a criminal act. It's an illegal act. And it's a retribution for an act committed allegedly by the Islamic State, which is supported by the Western Military Alliance. And when I say supported by the Western Military Alliance, we're talking about NATO, we're talking about Turkey, we're also talking about the Persian Gulf allies, and in fact, the war, that insurgency in Syria, that terrorist insurgency in Syria from day one in March 2011, was supported by the Western Military Alliance, and this is confirmed by reports emanating from the Israeli and Lebanese press. NATO and the Turkish High Command set up, right from the beginning, a process of recruitment of mujahideen from different countries to join rebel forces in Syria. And this is confirmed by Israeli intelligence sources.
Professor Rashad,
we've got a lot of other sources to that effect.
Professor Chostadovsky, one of the elements of this is, like, one of the terrorists, they said they found a passport that identified him as – it was a fake passport from somebody who had come across as a refugee from Syria. And now here's France has closed the borders. So I'm wondering what all the attacks mean in the context of that migrant, the refugee crisis.
Well, the issue of the passport, of course, is worth looking at because it's an issue pertaining to the planting of fake evidence and then using it, or at least the media will use it, without necessarily pointing to the fact that it could be fake. It's interesting that just recently, today, the German Minister of the Interior in an interview said that in his opinion this passport issue could be a fake, okay, could be misleading, and so that occasionally we get contradictory statements emanating from people in high office which will refute the media occurrence. In this particular case, it's the German Minister of Interior who made in an interview, I think it was with CNN, where he actually said this could be something which was planted. In fact, he said it's likely that it was planted. But with regard to the refugee crisis, I think Western public opinion should understand that this refugee crisis is the product of 4 years of war waged by the Western Military Alliance through their terrorist foot soldiers, and also by coalition bombings dating back to August of last year. And this has uprooted several hundred thousand people and these people don't know where to go. I should say that these are probably members of the middle class who have the money and the means to actually undertake, to actually go overseas from, to exit the refugee camps, which are based in Turkey, and take the long route towards Western Europe. But I think that there's a whole psychosis of what, you know, who is with those refugees and so on and so forth. One thing which has to be mentioned is that following the Russian bombings, which were consistent and effective, a large number of mercenary forces, which integrated the terrorist formations, have fled their command posts and have crossed the border into Turkey. And they have integrated the cohorts of refugees which are now moving towards Western Europe, so that there are terrorists within those ranks. Many of those people actually will be protected by their sponsors. We have to understand that. They were recruited by NATO, and now they are refugees. They may be given special treatment, and their access may even be facilitated. But certainly there are terrorists within the ranks of the refugees, but those terrorists are the handlers of the Western Military Alliance, who are fleeing the war theater as a result of the Russian bombings.
Okay. Well, I think we're about out of time now, but Professor Choskovsky, I want to thank you very much for sharing those thoughts with us, and I will have to keep in touch and continue to watch this story as it progresses. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you for the opportunity of being on the program.
Professor Chossadovsky is Emeritus Professor of Economics at the University of Ottawa and the founder and director of the Center for Research on Globalization. You've been listening to the Global Research News Hour. You can hear our programs every week on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and on partnering radio stations across the country. We are broadcast on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. You can also download each episode from the website globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. I am series host and producer Michael Welch. Join us again next week.